Comment t'as là?
But just. Good.
What are you working on?
That's why I was just talking to Mitch.
Call the House Interim Committee on Healthcare to order and open an informational meeting. We've got a pretty tight agenda today, so I'll ask the presenters to stick with it, and I'll give you a clue as to how much time we're planning for each. But Mr. Allen's ready to start.
I am.
Have at it, sir.
Good morning, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. I'm Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here to give you an update on the health insurance marketplace, and I'll touch on about four topics, and I usually talk pretty fast, and so I'll go through quick, but if you've got questions you want to interrupt or...
We've got about 20 minutes for this.
No problem. So first, in terms of the marketplace itself from an operational and financial standpoint, everything is well and really very boring. You're welcome. really the only thing of significance to report in terms of the marketplace operation is that one of the things that we took a little bit of administrative liberty within the agency to do was to fold in the Senior Health Insurance Benefit Assistance Program, SHIBA, which helps folks with questions about Medicare, into the team with the marketplace, because really they were accomplishing essentially the same function, using their expertise and a network of volunteers and community assisters around the state to help people make complicated decisions about health insurance. And whether that health insurance is provided by Medicare or by private insurers, a lot of the questions are the same, a lot of the resources are the same, and I'm very pleased actually with how that integration has gone. We've really seamlessly folded that function into the agency, and we've now got people who are actually able to answer both kinds of questions and be able to be used a bit more flexibly than we did before, and I'm going to come back to that in another issue to talk about. Second thing I'll mention, we're getting ready for open enrollment, which begins November 1st. I just reported yesterday to the Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee of eBoard on our marketing plans. Last year's marketing program had a target of trying to maintain the market share that we had of individuals in individual plans. The notion was we had just seen a fairly significant round of rate increases, and we didn't really have any experience to be able to rely on to have a sense of how price sensitive is enrollment in the marketplace. And so we were hoping to hold steady. We actually were able to increase enrollment by 31% over the year, and so we were quite pleased with that. Again, this year, one of our targets is to maintain market share, because again, we're looking at another round of rate increases, and we're concerned about the same basic issue. In terms of the actual marketing and outreach, I think you all have insurance, so I'm sincerely hoping none of you have seen any of our marketing or outreach, because if you have, we're targeting it poorly. We're really micro-targeting. We're not using much broadcast advertising. We're not using any general broadcast advertising. We're using some Spanish-speaking radio advertising and those kinds of things. We conducted some focus groups over the summer to refine our work on targeting for millennials and for the Hispanic community, but mainly what we're looking at are very targeted web ads, ads that show up on things like Pandora, targeted print advertising, and as I said, some Spanish-speaking radio advertising, those kinds of things. We have a relatively limited marketing and outreach budget. It's $4 million for the biennium, so about $2 million per open enrollment cycle, and probably 60% of that is actual what you'd think of as advertising, and the remainder is direct outreach through community partners and agents who really are a very, very important part of this effort. If you think about it, consumers who, if they're eligible for tax credits, tend to be relatively low income, are faced with, depending on where they are, 40, 50, 60, 70, maybe 100 different plan choices, and navigating that is something that I would find very challenging to do if I had the time to sit down and do it. And so the ability to work with a community partner, an assister, or an agent to navigate that process helps particularly get better choices. Things like purchasing a silver plan because it actually costs less because it has cost sharing for premium and deductibles versus a bronze plan that appears to be the least expensive, those kinds of things. So we expect to continue with that same kind of a marketing and outreach approach. I want to touch quickly, though it's not strictly a marketplace issue, I want to touch quickly on the failure of Oregon's health insurance co-op, because the marketplace did play a big role in dealing with the outfall of that. A couple of things. First, most importantly, from my standpoint, from a consumer protection standpoint, we were successful in getting virtually all carriers in Oregon to honor consumers' investment in their accumulators, their maximum out-of-pockets, those kinds of things. We were far enough into the year that there were potentially quite a few people who had met whatever their fairly significant out-of-pocket maximum up to $6,600 was, and we wanted to make sure those folks didn't have to start over again before they could access access care. And Oregon's carriers stepped up and did that, and we were able, with a couple of exceptions, to deal with that on a negotiated basis. And I'm really happy with that outcome.
Can I ask? Thank you, Mr. Chair. What were the exceptions?
Zoom Care, we issued an order to require them to do it, and LifeWise, which is exiting the market, and with similar circumstances, we were able to issue an order. So
they did in the end.
So they ultimately are doing it by virtue of authority. The other thing, though, I mentioned the kind of the seamlessness of folding Sheba into the effort. The main impact for the marketplace was we had about 12,000 individuals on and off the marketplace who needed to get new coverage. And our staff, working together with community partners and agents, did, and including having not only Sheba staff, but management staff, policy analysts, anybody who could pick up a phone, making phone calls to get people through the special enrollment period to get signed up for coverage. And it was really fairly tricky. The first month of the special enrollment period was easy because all you had to do was call into healthcare.gov or get on the website and say, I've lost my coverage because of Oregon's health insurance co-op, and you were able, without much difficulty, although through a fairly lengthy process, upwards of 2 hours on the phone, sometimes with our staff there to assist them, to get coverage. Jeez. After that, there was an alternative process that you had to have kind of special inside knowledge to navigate, and our staff, again, worked with consumers to do that. I'm pleased to say that depending on which data set you look at, we've got something like 70 to 75% of those consumers placed in new policies. CMS tells us that's the far and away the highest rate of successful placement of coverage, replacement coverage in any co-op failure anywhere in the country, and I'm really pleased with our staff's work on that. The last thing I'll talk about really is far afield of marketplace, but I know it's a topic you're interested in, and it's, I guess, what I would call our summer of instability in the marketplace, in the market generally. As you know, when rate filing rolled around in May, we ended up with some things that we expected and some things we really didn't expect. We didn't expect LifeWise specifically to exit the market, but we have a lot of carriers in Oregon, more probably than you would imagine would be supported by the size of our market. And so we expected over time for there to be some shakeout in that marketplace. And so a decision like LifeWise's, which had a relatively small number of members in Oregon, to exit the market was not something that was terribly surprising, and was kind of an orderly getting the market to a manageable state. What we didn't at all see coming were carriers in Oregon making decisions county by county about where they wanted to be. That really caught us by surprise. Now, looking back, it's fairly clear that this was a decision driven not by pulling out of counties that had populations that were particularly risky, but rather pulling out of counties because pulling out of a county is the only way really in the system you can actually reduce in a concrete way the number of customers you have. And we're really learning a lot and planning to come back and deal with this notion of right now our system is you file your rates on May 1st and you find out, congratulations, you're the low-priced carrier, here's your 70,000 customers. Which is just an inherently, and you're the new leader versus a carrier before who was the leader, and so those 70,000 customers become your 70. Now, there's a lot more complexity to it than that, but it's an inherently unstable kind of a system, and so we're developing legislative concepts that we expect to be able to come back and talk with you about in December legislative days to try to deal with that instability and really deal with three factors of instability. The affordability, because we've seen significant price increases over the last two sessions, and that's obviously an issue. The geographic instability. We believe Oregonians need to have a choice of provider or choice of insurers. Is that six carriers in remote counties in the state or not? That maybe is a little bit different issue, but choice in any case. And then financial stability for the carriers themselves. A world where people can't afford the policies and carriers are losing money is obviously not sustainable. And so those are the three elements that we're working on right now and refining a number of concepts and expect to come back in December to talk about. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions on any of that or anything else that's on your mind.
Pat, I'd like to follow up with the issue you raised about the deductibles. You and I have talked. I just want to put on the record, a former legislator had a situation where when he left the legislature, he went on COBRA. Right. And when COBRA ended, he picked another plan from the same carrier and found out that his deductible that had been essentially earned was not effective in a second plan for the same carrier. That seemed to be a problem, and you and I and Ms. Callie have talked about it. Do you want to comment on that in any way? And I know
I certainly understand the problem, and we're looking at it and trying to figure out if there is an existing regulatory ability to deal with that, or if that's something that we would need legislation to come back and try to address. And we'll be prepared in December to talk about that issue.
Good. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick.
Welcome.
Thank you. You mentioned that some of the carriers, when rather than exiting the market in totality, they exited county by county. Did you look at, or do you know if any of those decisions were based on the ability for those carriers to have providers?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that, and I probably should have spent a bit more time on that first. We were successful in, if I could characterize it as repurposing some legislation Representative Nose passed last session on an appeal process to use that appeal process a little bit creatively to engineer getting carriers back into counties. And so we ended the process with multiple carriers in every county. In terms of why carriers were exiting, I think there were two reasons, and I talked about the one being that being one of the only certain ways to limit the number of lives you cover. I think the other, I have to characterize it as anecdotal. It's what's reported to us, but I can't point to data that I can't prove it. But challenges by carriers to negotiate provider contracts in different parts of the state, and I think there are sort of, from what I observe of the comments, two flavors of that. One flavor is you're beginning to see carriers and providers move to an integrated system, either entities that have been that way forever, Kaiser, or have been that way for a fairly long time, like Providence, others that are fairly new partnerships, Legacy purchasing an ownership interest in Pacific Source is a good example. And I think one of the dynamics I'm concerned that we may be seeing is sort of if you're in that dyad, you can negotiate pretty straightforwardly. If you're outside that dyad, it becomes more difficult than it was before to negotiate a favorable contract. The other flavor of that, and again, based on anecdotal information, is more difficulty negotiating provider contracts in places where there are dominant monopoly or near monopoly providers on the hospital or physician network side, and ultimately, we're trying to be thoughtful about the things that we do on the insurance side to think about the impact that has on the ability of carriers to successfully negotiate with providers. So, for example, last year we required companies that hadn't even in some cases filed for increases in rates to raise the rates because we believed and continue to believe that at that time the market was pervasively underpriced. Well, you know, one of the outcomes of that is you kind of telegraph to the providers, go ahead and negotiate for whatever price you want because the insurance division will make the companies raise their rates to match that. So, you know, some thoughtfulness about sort of the downstream implications of the how we regulate the insurers, I think, is something we need to redouble our efforts to look at. And as well as we look at solutions to try to deal with those three flavors of instability, thinking about the impact on the provider side is a piece of it.
Commissioner Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I was going to ask a question about the 31%, but I do just want to say, building on yours, that I know that there's a lot of concern about people who go into perhaps an emergency room thinking that they're 100% covered in-network, and then their radiologist and their anesthesiologist and others are out-of-network. And so I think that's part of what you're getting at, how hard it is for especially small hospitals in Cottage Grove and other places to negotiate in good faith with carriers who, what we've heard, is offer very, very low rates, which would put them out of business. And so then they choose to not be in network because they can't accept that. And then people have to drive a really long, consumers have to drive a long distance. So I've been hearing a lot about that issue. I think that might be something that we deal with more in 2017.
Yeah, and Mr.
We will definitely be dealing with
that. Representative Kenny Geyer, if I could just comment briefly on that, we do anticipate bringing a concept or a bill on balanced billing to the session and dealing exactly with that issue, targeting the very most common problems like the anesthesiologist if for your pre-approved surgery that's in-network from providers that have all been figured out, and it turns out with no control of yours, you didn't know. The emergency room doctor is another one. There are a couple of other examples, but trying to deal with that issue. Okay.
Radiology and pathology.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Right. So, but the question that you triggered that for me, but the question I wanted to ask is, you mentioned that there was a 31% increase in people buying into the market mm-hmm. last year, but that it's uneven. Presumably it's uneven geographically or maybe at different income levels. Can you say anything more about that? Because there's obviously some price sensitivity, and yet overall more people bought in, but are there areas of particular concern?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, I didn't bring that data with me in my hip pocket. We can certainly provide the committee some further data. I would say our marketing and outreach is intended to focus at the counties where the largest numbers of uninsured remain. That's our target are those who don't have insurance. Obviously, in one sense, maybe not so obviously in another, in one sense, they don't have insurance and they're supposed to have insurance, so let's reach out to them. If they don't have insurance, they're probably healthier than people that do have insurance. So the more we can move up through the column of the uninsured, the more stable we make the individual market because we're capturing more folks who don't have insurance. There is geographic unevenness to that. I didn't bring the data to be
able
to
comment.
And
I'm also assuming at the lower income levels, presumably.
Actually, a couple of interesting dynamics, and again, it really has to do with health. If you're lower income, the mm-hmm. tax credits and cost sharing, if you get into the right plan, mm-hmm. Are pretty good, and we're actually pretty successful getting folks who mm-hmm. actually have an understanding that they need insurance into the market. Our focus groups with millennials was fascinating and terrifying. Mm-hmm. They're pretty much doing the math and saying, you know, that penalty's not that big a deal versus the premiums, and I'm young and healthy and, you know, sort of unsaid.
Immortal.
I'm not going to get hit by a car. I'm not going to get sick. I'm not going to whatever. People's mental approach to health insurance versus car insurance is really interesting.
My son, who's turning 26 in a week.
Well, personal confession, I have three youthful drivers in my house, so I spend $500 a month on car insurance, yeah. which I hope never to use, yeah. versus health insurance, where someone will spend $500 a month and hope to use it quite regularly and get their $500 of value out. It's a completely diametric construct. And so young, healthy people, although we're doing well in Oregon compared to other states, this continues to be an area where we need to work really hard to get people to purchase insurance.
Representative Buehler?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Greenlick. Pat, do you have concerns?
I think we'll move on.
Okay. Do you have concerns that summer of instability one will turn into summer of instability two, considering the double-digit price or rate increases, the declining number of carriers, and concerns about the declining health of the people entering the individual market?
Yeah, Chair Greenlich, Representative Bueller, that last part, unless I misunderstand, the more people who come into the market, the healthier they are rather than the less healthy they are.
Are you sure of that?
I'm reasonably sure of that.
How are you sure of that?
What we're able to identify about use patterns and the improving financial condition of carriers through claims data gives us some indication that that's the case. Also, simply logically, if you need to go to the doctor, you're going to get insurance. It's the people who don't feel like they need to go to the doctor that we need to get insured, and as we increase our penetration, we do better with that.
Or you've lost your job and now you're in the individual market.
That's true, too. But to your basic question, absolutely, we're concerned about continued instability. We'll know a lot when rate filing comes around, and there's sort of a intellectual argument that says, well, all of the temporary stabilizers that were going away and their departure was contributing to rate increases have now gone away. So those 5, 10, 15% hits that were occurring will stop. That's not a should stop. They will stop. The question will be, will we be successful in maintaining the enrollment we have in the marketplace, or will the enrollment decrease? Because just as, from a logical standpoint, new enrollment comes from healthier people, if people leave, they're probably healthier than the ones who stay. And if that happens, that will contribute to instability in the marketplace. And that's what we're going to be keeping an eye out for, and we're very concerned about.
And just a last comment. You're moving toward a plan on the basic health plan to offer us?
We will be bringing you back a blueprint for the basic health plan. That's right. We're also coordinating our research and work with the health authority as they look at similar charges they've been given on single payer and other options. So collectively, we'll be bringing you a number of potential policy options to consider with notions of cost and implications for the marketplace.
Great, Pat. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for the responsive work you do.
Thank you.
We'll move to the next agenda item, which is an update on CCO Oregon's activities. I'll call Sarah Love and Matt Sinoff, please. We have about 15 minutes for you guys to share.
Thank you, Chair Greenlich. Members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to present here today. For the record, my name is Sarah Love. I'm the policy director at CCO Oregon, and with me today is Matt Sinnott. He is both the chair of our dental work group as well as the chair of our board of directors at CCO Oregon. We're just here today to provide a little bit of background on our organization as well as some of the work that we've done in the past couple of years and how that has been incorporated into a variety of programs. CCO Oregon is a nonprofit member association that aims to be shaped by and to serve all stakeholders that touch coordinated care in Oregon. Our purpose is to support the delivery of exceptional care at reduced cost while promoting the health and well-being of Oregonians. CCO Oregon focuses on three core areas: collaboration and connections, research, analysis and reporting, and policy exploration. CCO Oregon membership network is comprised of healthcare leaders and coordinated care stakeholders. Our membership roster now includes multiple CCOs throughout the state, as well as a lot of the dental care organizations, health plans, hospitals and health systems, provider associations, federally qualified health centers, and technology companies. Our organizational structure is linear, with the board of directors that's sitting at the top. And then at the center, we have a policy committee, which is composed of multiple work group chairs as well as CCO representatives. And then the foundation is a variety of different work groups focused on different areas of coordinated care. These work groups are composed of the subject matter experts around the state, meeting monthly and focusing on specific topics, as I mentioned. Our current work groups are Dental, Integrative Behavioral Health Alliance of Oregon, or called IBEHAL, Pharmacy, Social Determinants of Health, and State and Federal Regulatory Affairs. Our policy committee and our board of directors is membership only as far as CCO Oregon membership, but our work groups do allow for participation from non-CCO Oregon members. We strive to be inclusive and allow for these limited number of stakeholders to participate without any financial obligation. This policy allows for multiple organizations to be able to participate, and up to 15 of the 16 CCOs did participate on a work group throughout 2016. Today, as I mentioned, we're going to highlight a couple of the work group's successes, including the behavioral health, and then Matt will talk about the dental work as well. Starting with the behavioral health, IBEHAL, or our Behavioral Health Work Group was founded in June of 2014 by primary care behavioral health integration experts from around the state. They include behavioral health providers, primary care providers, and representatives from health plans and health systems. This collaborative format allows for clinicians and leaders to thoughtfully discuss and promote the practice of primary care behavioral health and has allowed for their organizations to thoughtfully integrate many of the recommendations into their primary care practices, standardizing workflows, and creating best practices that can be replicated across the state. IBAHOW fosters this collaboration of comprehensive, evidence-based discussions. These discussions led to the creation of minimum standards for patient-centered primary care homes, or PCPCH, for providing integrated health care, and a copy of this should have been provided to you. This body of work was the result of an 8-month process utilizing resources such as the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, Behavioral Health and Primary Care Integration, and other research evaluating staffing models and ratios for behavioral health integration into primary care. In addition to many organizations using this framework when working with their clinics, this work has also been cited and incorporated into the 2017 PCPCH Technical Specifications and Reporting Guide as a best practice note. It's also a resource on the Patient-Centered Primary Care Institute webpage. IBAHOW is also listed on the Transformation Center webpage listing current activities in behavioral health integration. And I'll go ahead and turn it over to Matt to discuss our dental work.
Good morning. So I'm here to just highlight some of the activities that we've been up to on the dental work group setting. The dental work group is staffed by representatives from many of the dental care organizations and CCOs, along with representation from ORAC and the ODA, listening and being a participating party. So we focused in 2015 on trying to fill a void, and that void being trying to design a metric set that's sort of an off-the-shelf product that CCOs or the OHA could look at to better fill the gaps between medical dental integration and how to incorporate dental into the system at large. So we took a pretty comprehensive approach to this. We looked over about 130, 140 different dental metrics at a national level. We've rated those on a feasibility and relevance scale. And out of that, we created, in essence, a core metric set that we thought was fundamental to any service area in the state and was representative of the different member cohorts and transformational elements around pregnant women, ED, and even diabetic work. We also created an a la carte measure set that would allow CCOs some flexibility to, in essence, plug and play with some of the measures if they felt that their service area had more unique needs. At this point, those measure sets are done. They've been out into the community. We've had opportunities to present both to the metrics and scoring tag group, as well as the OHA's Medicaid Advisory Dental Access subgroup. And Sarah will actually be presenting the metric sets to the full metrics and scoring committee in December. And I think it's also facilitated pretty robust discussions, even at a CCO dental plan level. So I'll hand it back over to Sarah to bring it home.
Great. Thank you. So just to highlight a little bit of our final three work groups, our pharmacy work group is our most geographically diverse work group composed of CCO pharmacy directors representing 14 of the 16 CCOs throughout 2016. This group is focusing on high-cost emerging medications and the potential effect that increasing pharmacy spending has on the ability for a CCO to effectively manage population health in their communities.
Which two are not included?
So the two that are not currently included are family care and I will have to get back to you on the third one. Cascade. Oh, Trillium. Mm-hmm. And they've both been invited and that representation may change going into 2017. Our social determinants of health work group is composed of a variety of FQHCs, advocates, and CCOs focusing on how to bridge the gap between the delivery of health care and the basic services, such as food and housing, that impact health outside of the medical setting. Our final work group is our newest work group, our state and federal regulatory affairs, which is populated by a variety of public policy and government relations professionals that discuss legislative concepts related to coordinated care in Oregon. Our work groups continue to convene and work towards furthering health transformation in a coordinated care model. Our transparent, collaborative, and consensus-based policy development is a process we choose to utilize, which requires thoughtful dialogue to ensure high-quality work that will promote health in Oregon and work towards achievement of the triple aim. We're encouraged that our dental and our IBAHOW work groups are considered valuable resources and that their work products are referenced in a variety of settings. We hope that this will continue with all the CC Oregon work groups in the upcoming years. Thank you again for allowing us the opportunity to present, and we're available for any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Matt, you talked a little bit about the process. I wonder if you could say some of the findings for the in the oral health arena. This was something that our committee took on in big part last year, particularly with the fee-for-service, and I'll be asking that for the KPRO panel as well. But can you talk a little bit about what you actually came up with that you're suggesting to the metrics committee?
Sure.
Or any other arenas?
Sure. And I think it's an evolving space. Mm-hmm. Dental was added to the CCO process after, medical and behavioral health were really baked into the model. So I think, we were sort of behind the curve in terms of how we fit into the CCO incentive metric set. Mm-hmm. With the Sealant metric being added and then dental being added to the foster kids metric, I think it gave us an entree into that and really facilitated the conversation. Mm-hmm. So much of our work, and really I think it was facilitated by having pretty robust CCO participation in our work group, was really focused on looking at things like the pregnant women and the importance of the oral health piece as they are in their pregnancy stages and even post-pregnancy, mm-hmm. as that transition of care sometimes can miss the mark. We also focused on things around the ED, knowing with the EDI and pre-managed sort of proliferation, there's a real opportunity there. And we know what those numbers have looked like on a national scale, and even the study that OHSU did here in Oregon years ago. And then we also looked at things like the diabetes, knowing that the periodontal disease has real implications on diabetic management. Mm-hmm. We really were looking at what is out there as a validated dental measure, mm-hmm. with the work of the Dental Quality Alliance that the ADA is helping to navigate. It's probably the first time ever that you've had this much sort of collaboration and consensus on a national level looking at dental metrics. Mm-hmm. Some of those measures have been endorsed by the National Quality Forum. So naturally, those were areas that we sort of coalesced around, knowing that that's sort of your gold stamp of approval if you can get that NQF endorsement. We also wanted to balance the pediatric population as what is mandated under Medicaid, but then also with an emphasis on the adults. Mm-hmm. That's really what grew Oregon's Medicaid, 60%, 50-60% virtually overnight. And we know that there's a lack of emphasis on that population as compared to the pediatric population.
We're going to be back in this discussion later as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So
if you can send me any data that you have, that'd be great. Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you.
Representative Bueller, did you have a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Sarah, I really appreciate your effort to define minimum standards for behavioral health integration. It seems from my observation that the integration of behavioral and physical health has lagged behind some of the other foundational concepts in the CCO model. So one question is, why has that occurred? Why have we not seen more integration of the two aspects?
Thank you, Chair Greenlee, Representative Bueller. So there are a lot of challenges and barriers that go into that. Some of the things that the group has mentioned, both, again, we have providers, behavioral health providers, primary care providers, and health plans. Billing is an issue. Same-day billing has come up as a concern. Some of the other issues are just being able to have access, making sure that we do have the proper alignment and proper professionals in the clinic. I've heard concerns that clinics may hire a behavioral health provider in there, and if all the other providers may not be on that same page, if you don't have kind of a champion for that, just understanding what the roles are in the team. So I know a lot of clinics have done this really successfully, and those are some of the concerns and challenges that have come up. And if you're interested, I'm happy to follow up offline, and we can talk about other things, because this group did come up with also a list of challenges and barriers as well.
And I encourage you in drawing up your minimum standards for some areas that are non-metro, using telehealth to deliver behavioral services instead of synchronous conversation. I want to make sure that's in concept.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Bueller. That was definitely a discussion we had, because this is a statewide organization, and we do have representatives from Central Oregon on this group, and that was something that was brought up by multiple people, and we made sure to include that.
Okay. And one more question, Chair. I applaud you for developing the metric set for dental care. Is there an equivalent type of metric set for behavioral care?
This group has been interested in working on things like that. It is a very complex discussion. We had a meeting a few months back and spent several hours discussing this. And one of the concerns with that was metric fatigue. In terms of other ones, whether you're talking about like an NQF or something, there are metrics out there in terms of them being used in Oregon. I'm not sure. We haven't done anything like that. We've been discussing it, so that may be work coming in the future.
So just a point of clarification, so there is no equivalent metrics for behavioral health right now?
There are.
In Oregon? Used in Oregon?
Yes.
In
the there are. With CC Oregon has not specifically done that work like we did with the dental work, but there are groups that are doing that work elsewhere.
And they are included in the 18 metrics. So I think two are behavioral health.
What are those two?
One is the 7-day referral
and
in
an
acute crisis.
Okay.
I forget what the other one is.
But those are process measurements, not outcome measurements?
Correct.
That's a lot of the metrics.
Well, outcome measurements in mental health anywhere.
Yeah.
We work on that.
Okay, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to move to a presentation on Comprehensive Primary Care Plus Initiative. We have Ron Stock, Jane Conley, Mindy Stadlander, and Krista Shively, please.
Behavioral health stuff is just not working.
You guys have about 20 minutes.
Representative Greenlee, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Ron Stock. I am a clinical innovation consultant with the Oregon Rural Practice-Based Research Network, and we're here this morning to talk about a CMS program that is about to be initiated in Oregon in January, building upon a comprehensive primary care program that's been going on for about 4 years in Oregon, involving about 67 practices already. My role this morning is to really give you a high-level overview of the CPC Plus program, which is really going to change the way primary care is delivered in Oregon and how it's going to be paid for. There's a handout with the slides on there to refer to. I'm not going to go into detail. This is really for your information. If there are points on the slides or in the information you'd like, feel free to ask questions. So what are we trying to accomplish? Let's see if I can advance the slides. Doesn't seem to be advancing. So anyway, next slide. What we're trying to accomplish is, number one, is to meet the goals of the triple aim. And I can do that from right here. That's good. See if my left hand works. Or this one. So we're, certainly the goals of the CPC Plus program is number one is to achieve the triple aim. The second goal with this CMS program is to advance care delivery and payment to advance and improve and broaden the comprehensive care of in the primary care. And when we talk about comprehensive care, we're not just talking about medical care, but we're also talking about behavioral health care and also social addressing social determinants of health as well. But this program also emphasizes encourages primary care management of complex care and the complex needs of patients. The third is really to understand that practices are at different stages in terms of their redesign in the state, and that this program really accommodates where practices are at. Those practices that are just now beginning to think about redesign, and as well as those practices who have been doing this work for a number of years and really want to advance that. And then finally, this is really an opportunity for our state to begin to align payment quality measures and primary care delivery in Oregon, and particularly in bringing Medicaid and Medicare together so that we can begin to align those programs. So Oregon is one of 14 states and regions that received approval to become a region. Seven of these states have been doing this work over the last 4 years, Oregon being one of that. So we'll really be able to build upon what we've learned in the last 4 years. What is it? It's a 5-year program. It's a model that starts in January. It's the largest primary care model implementation in U.S. history. Thousands of physicians, thousands or clinicians, thousands of practices, and 12 about 25 million people will be impacted by this. And it requires a really close collaboration with our payers in the state. And in Oregon, there are 15 payers that have been selected. And here's a list of those. The first part of the process was to recruit payers in the state, and we'll be hearing from a couple of them on the panel here this morning. The second stage and phase of this program was to recruit practices, and the practices would be recruited within the region. The requirements, a practice needs to have at least 150 Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries within their practice. They need to be able to declare and demonstrate some readiness to participate in this program. And I think it's important to point out that there are some exclusions that are important here. One is that the concierge practices, the rural health clinics, and the FQHCs are not included in this program. Also, if you haven't picked up on this already, that because of the Medicare component to this, the pediatric practices also do not qualify for this program. The program design, as I said, addresses where practices are at. Track one being for those practices that are really wanting to get off the ground from the very beginning. Track two are those who have been participating in care. So how will care be different? What will it look like? All the practices will participate in addressing these five primary care areas. You can see that they will be involved in a learning collaborative together across the state and learn to bring best practices into the state involving these five primary areas. The second major piece is how the practices will be paid. And this is a busy slide, but I do want just to put your attention on the left-hand side there. These are three sort of primary strategies that will be used to pay. One will be a care management fee that practices will receive to supplement and help resource care coordination within their practice. The second is some hybrid changes in terms of how fee-for-service is managed within the practice. And the third is a quality and cost performance incentive. In other words, practices, if they meet certain criteria and performance standards, then they're able to keep the that payment within their practice.
This would be basic fee-for-service at the heart of it?
Basic fee-for-service is at the heart of it. In the Track 2 practices, there will be a hybrid moving away from the basic fee-for-service so that part of the fee will be prospectively given to the practice based on the previous year revenues, and they will receive that up front, and then the fee-for-service payment will be reduced for those encounters when people come in. But they will get the money up front, encouraging practices to use emails, to use group visits, to be using other alternatives to connect with patients and families outside of the traditional clinic setting. The timeline, this has been a very short timeline.
There won't be full capitation.
I'm sorry.
There won't be full capitation in any of these.
Right. The timeline, this was launched in April. The payers were recruited, and the regions announced at the end of July. The practices have just submitted their applications to be participants in this practice as of September 15th, and they'll find out probably sometime in November, and then the program gets launched in January. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to turn it over to Jane here from folks who have actually participated in the past CPC initiative to talk a little bit about what they've learned.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jane Conley, Clinic Administrator for Springfield Family Physicians in Springfield, and my role is to give you an idea of how CPC has helped our practice. 65 clinics in Oregon, including ours, were part of this four-year program. We received about $250,000 a year in alternate payment, PMPM, kind of payments for this program. And it's important to note that none of this money was going into physician pockets. We had to prove how we spent every penny of this money for improved patient outcomes, staff, increased staff, and those kinds of things. With that additional income, we hired a registered nurse, several in-office mental health experts, and transitions of care planners who contacted all of our emergency department and discharged patients, and extra medical assistance for each provider. Our RN functions as our diabetic educator and has made an incredible impact in the practice. Most of our patients with out-of-control diabetes have seen her, and of the ones who've seen her, more than 70% have had an improvement in their A1Cs, and these are people who've had no improvement in their relationships with our physicians under our previous care. Our mental health professionals have become such an integral part of our team that none of our providers can imagine practicing without them anymore. Last year, we referred more than 700 patients to them, warm handoffs and continuing therapy in the office. For the past 4 years, our transition of care managers have contacted every patient who's been in the ED or been discharged from the hospital, updating the medical records, updating the medications that they were put on by other providers, making sure that their new diagnoses were entered into our records. Our additional medical assistants have allowed us to provide much better care for our patients and most effectively preventive care. The extra help allows the support staff to scrub the patient's charts prior to their visit. We actually are looking at you before you come into the office and looking for care opportunities and preventive care so that our ability to help our patients stay healthier has become much improved. Because the team caring for the patients has expanded, there's much more time for educating and following up with patients after the visits. We actually find out if they've done what we recommended. These are not services we could offer in the past because they were completely unpaid or were severely underfunded. The results of these additions have been significant. Comparing our first quarter of 2014 to our first quarter of 2016, these are the changes. We've added 104 Medicare patients. We currently have about 1,000 Medicare patients enrolled in our CPCI program. We have decreased our per-patient expenditures by 5.5%. This is CMS data. We have decreased our hospital admissions by 8%. We have decreased our ED visits by 12.5%. We've decreased our 30-day readmissions by 13%. We've all seen such a huge improvement in the care that we provide, we really cannot imagine going back to how things used to be. We're excited about the possibilities of CPC Plus. We've applied to be one of the clinics who are in this new program. Unfortunately, our CCO, Trillium, has chosen not to participate, and so we are uncertain whether we are going to qualify under the new requirements. Because we have more than 25% of our patients who are Medicaid and they have thresholds, they would prefer to have all of our covered lives up to 60% of our practice be in participating payers. We don't meet that threshold. We hope we will be accepted, but we just don't know. Thank you.
Okay, we can share. Good morning, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Mindy Statlander. I'm the Executive Director of Network and Clinical Support for Care Oregon. Care Oregon provides the Oregon Health Plan to approximately 250,000 Oregonians through our affiliation with four CCOs. And we also have a Medicare Advantage program that serves approximately 12,000 Oregonians, most of whom are dually eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare. And Care Oregon, along with two other payers and the state, were participants in both the original Comprehensive Primary Care Initiative and are participating in CPC Plus, another of whom is to my right. The CPC model and CPC Plus, we feel, are great examples of how CCOs can swiftly implement innovative ideas to transform the way that healthcare is delivered in Oregon. And 13 out of the 16 CCOs are involved in the new CPC Plus alternative payment methodology. As an aside, this is totally awesome and necessary, but absolutely not sufficient. This cannot be just a Medicaid and a Medicare improvement effort. This takes all of us getting together to work to support primary care. For us, though, CPC and CPC Plus align with the work that we have been doing in alternative payment and federal work around the Healthcare Payment Learning and Action Network, which has helped define the definition for what alternative payment methodology means and how you tie alternative payment to quality and value. At this point, 65% of our payments are through mechanisms that are tied to quality and value as defined by this methodology. And because of our efforts efforts in this area, we've expanded the kinds of alternative payments, not just to those who qualify for CPC Plus, but also to pediatric practices, FQHCs, and the rural health centers that are in our network, because we believe that this work is so important and just didn't want to limit it to only the set of practices that met that, both eligibility criteria and the Medicare fee-for-service lives requirement. So at this point, our alternative payment model spread more than 150 practices statewide. We have been talking with our CMS partners about how to move that requirement and to allow other kinds of practices to participate in CPC Plus. We've represented to them that for Oregon, this is really important, and there is some small receptivity to that. For Care Oregon, we have had a long history of developing robust primary care payment methodologies that are co-developed between our providers and the health plan. And that has allowed our practices to focus on what is important clinically to their particular patient population. And we've seen improvements similar to those that my colleague on the practice side has seen. So we intend to replicate the same experience in CPC Plus, including addressing the need for integrative behavioral health services. We've expanded a model that we learned about through colleagues in Colorado, which has been another benefit to us to participation in CPC. We can connect with other payers, both within the state, but also nationally, to understand what's working for them. I also wanted to mention that we extremely appreciate the work that SB 231 group is doing, and are hopeful that CPC Plus can be a starting point as a way to align around principles. The SB 231, that is the Alternative Payment Collaborative for Primary Care. And that is a multi-stakeholder group of all the payers and practice participants, and then a handful of other representatives. We hope that that can be a group that helps align the principles of primary care payment. A subset of us are participating in CPC Plus, but we'd love to be able to use that as a venue to expand the set of principles that we are implementing. And we believe that these multi-payer tables across all lines of business are critical for transformation to support our primary care partners.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Krista Shively, and I serve as Senior Director of Quality and Medical Integration for Providence Health Plans. Providence Health Plans is a strong proponent of patient-centered models of care and easing the way for patients as they navigate the healthcare system to improve and sustain their health and well-being. We have a long history of implementing innovative payment models, starting with our Medicare Advantage plan, which has been in existence for about 30 years. Our medical home model that we implemented for PEB has also been expanded to multiple commercial populations over a decade. And in Medicaid, many of the features of the CCO model of care had previously been part of Providence's model of care. However, we know from working with our provider partners that it is difficult for practices to implement transformational changes without multi-payer participation and alignment. Payment changes to support additional services, such as integrated pharmacy and behavioral health, need to be supported from multiple payers. Practices also need to be less dependent on fee-for-service payments, which are visit-based, and be shifting towards revenue that supports alternative models of care, including telehealth, group visits, phone calls and emails, really meeting patients in the care setting that best meets their needs. We see CPC Plus as an opportunity to facilitate this kind of alignment across payers, but we are concerned about the uneven participation among the within the commercial marketplace in the participation of CPC Plus. So Dr. Stock noted that there are 15 payers that have volunteered to participate in CPC Plus. Many of these are CCOs representing the Medicaid population, but Providence Health Plan is the only commercial health plan that has participated in both CPCI and is participating in CPC Plus moving forward. And I would note that there are about 7 commercial payers that make up 5% or more of the commercial market share. And it's important that that population be represented in the CPC Plus moving forward. Lack of multi-payer participation creates challenges in the adoption and implementation for practice participants. And I'll use the existing data from CPCI, the seven regions of the country that participated in CPCI, to illustrate how a penetration of payer participants within a practice directly correlates to the resources available to support transformation. Oregon actually had the second highest number of Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries attributed to the CPCI model. So 53,000 Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries have been receiving, on their behalf, Medicare has been paying care management fees for the last 4 years. When you add that traditional Medicare population with the Providence population and the Care Oregon population, as well as the three additional payers in CPCI, that penetration at the practice level equates about 26% of the practice panel. In other areas of the country, this was we saw far higher amounts. So by comparison, Hudson Valley, New York, which was also participating in CPCI, had a 55% penetration of payers. This equates to real dollars and resources for primary care practices. The average CPCI contribution in Hudson Valley was $58 per patient annually. By comparison, in Oregon, the average annual CPC contribution across payers was only $32. So while Jane's experience and the transformations she's been able to implement are absolutely notable, some of that is based on the payer mix that she experienced in her practice, and that can be very uneven for practices participating across Oregon. From a health plan perspective, we've seen very uneven results in the ability to implement the model changes. The resources directly correlate to the ability to add staff for care managers to implement integrated behavioral health technology investments that support analytics and reporting to help close gaps in care. So while we have been participating for the last 4 years and continue to support the model, we are concerned about the future success of CPC Plus because it hinges on strong multi-payer support across all types of payers, traditional Medicare, Medicare Advantage, CCOs, commercial plans, and even self-insured employers. Both CPCI and CPC Plus require practices to transform care for all patients served by the practice, not just a segment of the population that's supported by the payer that is volunteering for the initiative. So to have sufficient resources to accomplish that requirement, there really can't be freeloaders. And right now, the payers that are not participating are still getting benefits from the model. Although Providence Health Plans has committed to CPC Plus for the next 5 years, we want this to be a sustainable model moving forward, and that requires payers to all pay their fair share. So thank you for the opportunity to make these remarks.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay,
I just have a quick question about track one.
Hayden?
I think I missed something. Why is there a track one? Track two is very appealing because we have hybrid alternative payments. Track one is just a fee for service.
Well, track one are really those practices that have not been involved in previous programs or the CPCI program. So they're really sort of starting at scratch at step one. And so the belief is that they will receive the care management fee to help hire the folks that are needed. And they're really going to be starting from the ground level to develop their practice. I think the intent was in track two. Was to entice or to encourage practices that have been or further down the road to really take on more complex patients, particularly dementia or cognitively impaired patients or folks with multiple chronic diseases. And the feeling is that we need to get away from the standard fee for service and to begin to look at a hybrid of a fee for service and a prospective payment type of model.
Thank you. Yeah.
And Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Green. I have a two-part question. First part would probably be directed towards Mr. Stock. On the 15 participating players in the CPC, I note that some of them didn't. Do we know why they chose not to participate? And I'm from Lane County, so specifically also with Trillium. Is there a reason there?
Yeah. I don't have that information. I think that's probably information you'll need to find out from those that chose not to do it. I think of the 16 CCOs, 13 are participating. So I don't know if my pair colleagues know.
So there wasn't feedback on why they chose not to.
Yeah, I think that's information is probably within the pair groups that chose not to do it. You'll need to get information from them about that.
Second part of the question is probably directed towards the rest of the panel. I note that oral health, as an oral health provider, is an important part and sometimes the only contact that some of these patients have for health care for long periods of time. Will the clinics that become certified or approved or however that process takes place later this year integrate oral health, and if so, how?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden. I can speak from our experience. We have created a clinic and dedicated space to the concept that we will embed dentistry in the future. In the CPCI program, there were choices. We could choose from a menu of things that we were able to do. We chose integrating behavioral health. And embedded pharmacy and embedded dentistry is absolutely on our radar, and we understand completely that we cannot accept the full spectrum of care of a patient without that critical element in our office. So we hope to do that. There are many elements to this integrated process, and our idea of what primary care consists of is expanding daily. But from our clinic standpoint, embedded dentistry is very high on the list.
We also see other types of practices than those who are participating in CPC Plus working to integrate oral health strategies, the first tooth type screening, bringing in a hygienist to do sealants, and that's part of why we believe that expanding this to pediatric practices and to our FQHCs is incredibly important.
And I might add that I think this is the great opportunity we have of bringing the CCOs and the Medicaid with Medicare into the state. There's nothing specifically in the CPC Plus materials, if you will, that addresses dental health or oral health. But one of the things that bringing the CCOs and our current system transformation in this state is that we can begin to bring in oral health into the mix and to support that, not just within the OHP population, but also within the Medicare population as well.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Sounds like you have a very exciting project going on. I think it's amazing you got as many private carriers as you did, rather than the fact that some of them didn't get in. Okay, we're going to move now to a discussion about care integration in the open card fee-for-service system. And let me call Dr. Jeffrey McWilliams, Michael Wolf, John Del Palma. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
About time.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Michael Wolf. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to come and talk about our role with OHP to help the non-CCO Medicaid members navigate the complexities of the healthcare system. Let me talk at first about the key takeaways from today's presentation. The Oregon Open Card Program serves as the backstop for the Oregon health plan and brings added value to the state's efforts to transform the healthcare system. The program, which is administered by KeyPro, complements the coordinated care model by ensuring that no OHP member falls out of coverage. We're often asked the simple question, is it open card versus CCO? And we would say absolutely not. It is a partnership, and one that ensures that all Oregonians are receiving the right care at the right time and in the right setting. And finally, final key takeaway from today's discussion is the fact that we have been doing this for a number of years now at KeyPro and prior to that APS Healthcare. and that we have been able to help save the state of Oregon $85 million over the last 6 years. So let me spend just a second talking about KEPRO before I turn it over to my colleagues to talk about the program specifically. Some of you may not recognize the name KEPRO. It is APS. This program was originally from APS Healthcare. KEPRO acquired APS Healthcare in May of 2015, and we have just been renewed in our contract here, which I know John will talk about in a minute. KEPRO was founded in 1985 by the Pennsylvania Medical Society, and is one of the nation's largest CMS-designated quality improvement and care management organizations. We are headquartered in the state of Pennsylvania and have offices in the number of states that you see listed. Those are also the states that we work in the Medicaid programs in one form or another. We are an organization that is firmly committed to local management operations in the states that we serve. Our Oregon office is located in Tualatin, with caseworkers and care managers located around the state. And with that, I'll happily turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is John DePalma. I've been the executive director since 2012, now in my fifth year with KEPRO, and remember APS Healthcare, used to be APS Healthcare. So we're now servicing approximately 12% of the overall Medicaid population in the fee-for-service side of the business and integrating all mental, dental, and behavioral health together in order to help the clients navigate the very complex system that is our medical system to get the care that they need and ensure that they have the primary care physician that's taking care of them from the beginning. Our work in 2016 has also expanded into some more specific behavioral health work, and I'll talk about that in just a couple minutes. Some of the characteristics of our program in the fee-for-service business include some very specialized populations, including the dual eligibles, which we currently have about 32,000 duals, the American Indian and Alaska Natives, which we've developed great relationships with the tribes and working with them and trying to maximize the health care that we provide there. And some of the other specialized populations are listed as well on this slide. But we're totally, right now we have a total of 125,000 total members that we service. On page six, we just showed kind of where the population is. There's no big surprises on this map. Most of the population runs along the I-5 corridor, as you can see, and it's very consistent with the overall population. On page seven, I'll talk a little bit about some of the services we provide. But we have health coaches on staff that provide both telephonic assistance to our clients, and also we do person-to-person interaction, especially in transitions of care out of the hospital and into other facilities. We do also provide a 24-hour nurse line so that clients can call us at any time 24/7. We utilize a proprietary software called the Percolator in order to analyze the claims that we get from OHA and identify who the sickest of the sick are and what those particular disease types may be. And then we assign acuities to each of the members from 0 to 5. Those that are 4 and 5, we pay special attention to in the field and trying to get face-to-face with those folks to try to maximize their care. We conduct outreach to our members that leads to an assessment. That assessment then leads to a plan of care, and that plan of care hopefully will focus on their medication compliance, on the right exercise and diet, education about what their particular diseases are, and getting them to a better quality of life. I'll now turn it over to Jeff and let him talk about some of our coordination services. Dr. McWilliams?
Sure. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Jeffrey McWilliams. I'm the medical director for KEPRO. I've served in that role since 2012. And on this slide, which you can all read, and I'm not going to read to you, these are just some examples of some of the strategies that we use when we get face-to-face with clients. A couple that I want to point out is that we strive to do in-home face-to-face medication reconciliation for those higher acuity members who are in a transition of care from a hospital to another facility or even to home. It's surprising when you actually get in the home and have them pull out their pill bottles what kinds of stuff they have that that may not have been obvious during hospitalization. The other thing we do in-home assessments for fall risk and have a fall prevention program. Data would indicate that as much as 50% of rehospitalizations can be prevented just by eliminating medication errors and eliminating or preventing falls. As you can see, we also interact with quite a few patients with serious and persistent mental illness, and John will talk about that in a moment as well.
Yep, on page 9, we talk about the actual ROI that we've been able to generate. And in the first six years of our program interaction with OHA, we've been able to drive a savings of $85 million in healthcare costs versus what the Oregon Health Authority anticipated spending. So by getting people the right care, by getting people to use their PCP, and by getting them to use the healthcare system effectively, we're able to keep members out of emergency rooms and minimize the costs as much as possible. So that personal interaction that we've been able to have with them is certainly something that pays off. I'm going to turn it over back to Jeff to talk about specifically the hepatitis C project.
Yeah, thank you. So we have a hepatitis C project looking at compliance that I wanted to present to you, mostly to give you an example of some of the innovative or different ways we're approaching healthcare problems that we see in our members. I like this project because it demonstrates a kind of threefold collaboration where the collaboration with the Oregon Health Authority or the public sector, us, the private sector, and then actually the academic sector. We're working with faculty members from the Oregon State University College of Pharmacy, and together we have created a project for managing patients getting very expensive therapy, the hepatitis C direct-acting antiviral therapies, who are fee-for-service patients. We offer the same care coordination services to patients with hepatitis C getting treatment as any of our other members. But in addition to that, we do extra coordination with the prescribing physician or nurse practitioner, the filling pharmacy, as well as the individual patient. And we have a core group of two nurses and two care coordinators who actually speak to the patients in active therapy every day to be sure that they're taking their medication. And so bonds get formed, and actually we see a tremendous compliance rate. So far we have treated 21 people, or coordinated rather, 21 people. Nine of them have successfully completed their therapy. We've overseen 952 doses of the medication. This is 1 week old data, so add 7 to those numbers, I guess. And what we found is a compliance rate of 99.5% of taking the medicine. You know, there isn't great data, but the best data we have is that in the best circumstances, patient medication compliance might hit 70% in highly motivated patients. So our goal here was tremendously expensive therapy with very promising outcomes. But if we're going to use this expensive medication, it would be nice to ensure that it's used properly. As an added benefit, our care coordinators found two of the 21 open card members who actually had third-party liability insurance that wasn't known to us and should have been responsible for the medication. And in both cases, we got the third party to pay for the medication, one even retrospectively. So it's about $100,000 per treatment cycle. So that was a $200,000 savings that occurred.
Thank you, and I'll wrap up with a couple of final topics. I wanted to talk just quickly about the behavioral health initiatives, and we're excited about this. We've actually hired a psychiatrist. Dr. Loretta Young has joined our staff. We've also hired several staff that are focused on behavioral and are licensed in that profession. That staff is already working with the Oregon State Hospital to help improve the plan of minimizing stays in the state hospital and getting our clients into the optimum placement in the community with the proper services to support them. So that's an exciting relationship that has just begun as of July 1st. On page 12, we talk about the CCO relationship and how we have really reached out to the CCOs to try to do warm transfers when members are going from us to them or from them to us. And we want to make any kind of transition that the member has to go through as seamless as possible. We're also working with OHA to look at network adequacy and make sure that we have PCPs in all areas of the state that can service our clients, as that is the mainstay for getting the care established for each of them.
How's that going? Sorry.
Question is, how's that going?
Chair Greenlick, that is going well. There are areas of the state that we're struggling with. We're just collecting data right now and doing a more in-depth analysis. The state's just recently asked us to do that and identifying where members are and then how many PCPs are in each of those areas, looking at those ratios and identifying where the gaps are. And then we'll start working on the gaps.
Okay. I have a question. To start the questions. You have roughly 110,000 people at your population. Roughly how many of those do you actually have any kind of direct contact with in a year?
So all of them will get materials from us as soon as the program is available to them, as soon as they get Medicaid. And then approximately 20% are enrolled in a acuity of 1 to 5. And then the focus really that we have to put on in the field is on those 4s and 5s, the ones that are most critical.
How many would that be in a year?
The numbers would vary. I would have to give you probably the full report to give you a real accurate answer. But we do produce an annual report that details all of that information.
How about a rough answer? I mean, is it 200 or 12,000?
Go ahead.
If I might, Chair Greenlick, approximately 2% of the population is the highest acuity and the ones that we interact with the most. 2%.
So maybe 5,000?
Yes.
That would be a good rough number, yeah.
Well, that would be 5%, maybe
2,000.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Kenny Geyer and then Representative Bueller.
Do you want to go first?
Go ahead.
Representative
Bueller. Because I have three and you might end up asking one of them.
Okay, mine's pretty straightforward. Okay. So, question about strategic direction. My impression is that this legislature has been clear that we should move into the CCO delivery model for the Medicaid population. Why are we seeing enrollment and growth of the open card OHP?
Well, we saw a great increase in the overall population during Medicaid expansion. So I have been around since 2012, so I've seen it all. It's been down as low as 42,000. When OHA agreed to add the duals population to our population, that added about 28,000 to the population. So that made it grow further. And then with Medicaid expansion, it actually took us up to 132,000, and now we're sitting right around 125,000.
You can't push the dual eligible into CCO.
Yeah, it's like a
member
CCO.
Why? Why?
Federal regulation.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So three questions. I'll try to make them really quick. One, Michael, thank you for meeting with me about a month ago. We talked about the challenge of linking pregnant women who are there because of categorical eligibility. They're only there for a short period of time. And we learned in 2015 that the rate of fee-for-service or open card pregnant women getting dental care was only 20%, and they were only being seen 30 days before delivery on average. And you were going to go back and look at, you know, has this been an issue that you've been able to collaborate with OHA? And if so, what are some of the barriers? What have you been doing to try to make that linkage faster?
So let me take that. Representative Kenny Geyer. It is a huge initiative at OHA with the folks that we interact with. Dr. Bruce Austin is the dental director. Trevor Douglas, who is our primary contact, has gotten us in touch with him, and there are meetings scheduled to talk specifically about this issue and what we can do further to coordinate care, especially around dental and pregnant women who need to see a dentist.
Okay, so in the last couple of years, that's not been one of those. When you talked about what are the populations and what are the touches that you do, that has not, as of yet, been a focus for you because it's such a short period that you have them.
Yeah.
It sounds like that's not been, as of yet, a big focus, but will be going forward.
If I might add, Representative Kengeyer, it's correct that it's a clearer focus now than in the past. However, we have been doing some things. One of our challenges has been literally finding the women who have become pregnant and getting engaged early in the prenatal episodes. And so we've worked on trying to get that data sooner. Some of our nurses go out and do community events, especially if they're geared toward women's health or pregnancy pediatric issues, to try to engage and let those women know about dental services, which they may not know that they have coverage for. And also, we do have a unique group of pregnant women who come into fee-for-service because they've chosen an out-of-hospital birth and then go back to their CCO. We have a nurse that coordinates that program, and the first day that she contacts the pregnant woman, she says, "We need to get you to a dentist." So although that's a small group, that's what we've been doing in the last 6 to 9 months.
Okay, thank you. And then can I ask two quick follow-up questions?
Sure.
One is, you talked about the personal contact and hiring nurses to do outreach. Have you been using traditional healthcare workers at all in your strategy?
So I would say we coordinate with all types of services throughout the entire state. Our nurses interact with the AAA offices, with the APD offices, coordinate services. We interact with community-based employees. I would say we touch just about every kind of community worker that could be out there to help us and provide services.
Okay, great. So if you can let me know how, because I know some CCOs are actually employing traditional healthcare workers and others are getting grants to community groups to help with those linkages. If you could let me know in what way you're using them at all, either contracting out or under your own employment, that'd be great. And the last thing I wanted to know is, these are great return on investments, $85 million saved from what we would have saved, and I see other areas of possible expansion of that. But what is the cost of the contract that OHA has with you over the last 6 years?
So it's varied quite a bit. This current contract, not to exceed amount, is $26 million, and that includes all the new behavioral services. That's for a 3-year period.
Okay, but over 6 years, do you have that figure, the $85 million, how that would compare to what the contract has been?
I do. I can provide that for you.
Okay, thank you so much.
I'm Sam Nose. And Representative Hayden.
That's more of a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just think we have to sort of think about this organization as sort of like the 17th CCO. Like, I had sort of a similar reaction or thought when I first met with them. Like, oh, I thought everybody was in a CCO. I didn't understand the whole open card system. I mean, I just had no knowledge of it. And I think we have to, like, include this in our frame when we think about how the Oregon Health Plan is delivered. At least that's how I've been trying to organize it in my head.
If I might, Representative Nose, I use similar language when I'm out and people say, well, what do you really do? I say, well, we kind of are the CCO for people who aren't in a CCO. And then we all in this room know that isn't true. We don't have a panel of providers and what have you. But it is a large portion of the
You also
Medicare
don't have
population.
The fiscal responsibility.
Pardon me?
You also don't have the financial responsibility for the patient.
Yes.
But, yes. Yeah, I think it's analogous.
Yeah.
Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Would love to comment and then a question. Would love to see that 2% of direct contact be increased. I mean, you're talking about 2,000 or 3,000 patients there out of a pool of over 100,000. But what are you specifically doing under our CCO relationships with the state? They're required to have a provider panel in that provider panel is required to be adequate to take care of what they get assigned. What are you doing specifically with the open card so that the state has a required or meets some sort of minimum provider network?
So, Representative Hayden, I'll address that. This is a huge priority for OHA. That's why they're asking us to get involved with measuring adequacy in the networks. It is clear, other than reaching members, I would say it is our number one challenge. Basically what we get, the feedback we get is that the providers will not accept open card. We beg and grovel and plead for them to help see our members. We do keep a database of our own database of those members that we've reached, that are of those providers that we've reached, so that we know kind of where we stand with them, and we do call them occasionally to see if they'll change their minds. But we basically are groveling and at their mercy whether or not they're going to accept seeing our open card members.
Follow up.
Quickly.
So, what incentive? What carrot do you have? I mean, what are they giving you to go out? I mean, you can do all the, you know, we increase the direct contact, we get that to hopefully 50,000 members, whatever. But once you do that and you're successful with what you're presenting here, it's one thing to have a piece of paper that says you have insurance. It's another to have a doctor to go to.
Exactly. And when we can't find one locally, we have several things that we can do to work on transportation and get them to go to a different doctor. There's a lot of creative things that my staff has done over the past 7 years to get them to a PCP, but that is clearly the number two challenge after getting a hold of clients and keeping a clear phone relationship with them, is to get them to a PCP on a consistent basis. And whether that's locally or whether we have to travel them to a different county, we'll do whatever we have to do to get them there.
Representative Mueller?
Yes, thanks, Chair Greenlee. Just to follow up, I just detect an internal tension between the strategic direction of moving away from fee-for-service into the CCO model and what you all do. And I understand there's a certain patient population that is not eligible for CCOs, but that population that is, what are you doing to move them into this appropriate CCO?
So, Representative Bueller, We are focused on the members that we have. I don't believe that's our role to move them into CCOs unless it's appropriate to do so.
Are we not clear on the strategic direction that this legislature has developed to move people into a per member per month and away from fee for service into a coordinated care model?
Right, but as the contractor from OHA, I believe we handle the members that come over on the eligibility file. So if those members are strategically supposed to be moved to a CCO, that would happen at OHA before we would get it. But we get an updated eligibility file once a week, and that's the membership that we service.
And Representative Bueller, we have that process. We have no control over.
Maybe you need more direction?
Or if they think this is the vehicle for doing that. We'll have that chance in a few minutes.
Okay.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to move to a discussion on pharmacy take-back programs. We're going to call Margaret Shield to talk to us. And Representative Bueller, I know you're working on this topic. Would you like to kick off a little discussion on the pharmacy take-back thing and where you're going?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Chair Green. I think this is a very important discussion to have. There is both health and environmental concerns about inappropriate disposal of prescription drugs. And Senator Steiner Hayward and I have been working on this through the summer with a couple of different concepts. I share the direction overall in trying to address this. The way to finance it is, like many things, the key thing. I think we have some ideas about that and hope to bring something back to you during the legislative session to address it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that there are multiple approaches to where we're going. We'll figure out some way to get it all together, but perhaps you can talk about where you are with this.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Good morning, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. Thanks for having me come and speak with you this morning about the need for safe disposal of leftover medicines. So my name is Margaret Shield. My background is in health sciences. And for the past 10 years, I've been working on environmental health policies for local governments and most recently as a consultant. I've been working on medicine take-back programs and pharmaceutical stewardship policies since 2008 and have seen many developments in this area, have seen changes in federal regulations that make these programs easier to operate, have seen a lot more awareness of the problem and the need for these programs, but we're still dealing with some barriers to making these programs really convenient for all of our communities. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the environmental health, the environmental and public health concerns, how these programs work, and the new opportunities for more convenient take-back, and then talk about the pharmaceutical stewardship policies that have passed in 9 counties so far in California and in Washington. Given all the, you know, all the issues on your agenda and the amount of time, I'm going to go through some of this information pretty quickly, but I will be very happy to provide you with citations and background information about any of what I cover today. And let's see, how do I advance the slides here? Okay. So medicines are essential to our lives to treat diseases and keep us healthy, but medicines in our home are also the cause of many poisonings, overdose deaths, and unfortunately, our home medicine cabinet has really become the new drug dealer in our community. Poisonings and overdoses are caused by all sorts of medicines, prescription and over-the-counter, especially among children and seniors. Painkillers are among the most problematic drugs with addiction, and I'll say some more about that in a moment. But stimulants, ADHD drugs, and many others are also abused. Even some over-the-counter medicines like cough syrups and antihistamines and decongestants are misused, especially by preteens and teens. You know, easy access to the home medicine cabinet gives young folks the opportunity to experiment with pharmaceuticals that they think are safer than street drugs. So having leftover medicines in our home that we really don't need contribute to these problems, and we need to be educating residents to store their medicine safely and get them out of the home and dispose of them properly when they don't need them anymore. So then waste medicines need to be disposed of properly. Flushing them or throwing them in the trash contributes to pharmaceutical pollution. There are many sources of pharmaceutical pollution, but those waste medicines are something that we can address right now. Even at low levels, pharmaceuticals are impacting our aquatic ecosystems, they're entering our food web, and they're even being detected at very low levels in some of our drinking water supplies. So really, when you look at pharmaceuticals as a waste chemical, it's a hazardous material that needs to be handled properly. They're not effectively treated or degraded by wastewater. Trash disposal is not secure at the curb. And that's why you may have heard of some kind of messy and difficult advice about mixing drugs with kitty litter before hiding them in the trash. The same waste medicines that come from our hospitals or pharmacies are not allowed to be landfilled. They have to go to a proper disposal facility. So we're trying to get similar options for households. The FDA, the DEA, and the EPA all recommend medicine take-back as the best disposal method, and only if there are no medicine take-back programs available, then trash disposal is a last resort. So this issue of leftover medicines is a significant problem. So estimates vary, but perhaps a third of medicines sold go unused. So there are many reasons for this, and these are important reasons to address. Some of them can be addressed through changes in prescriber or patient behavior. But some of these reasons detailed on the slide are really just part of our health care and part of how we use medicines to treat diseases and then don't need them, can't use them all sometimes. We can keep those waste medicines from causing poisonings, addiction, or pollution. Then the problem of our medicine cabinets serving as drug dealers has really been gaining attention as our country has been recognizing really a crisis of opioid abuse and heroin use. And in fact, this week is Prescription Opioid and Heroin Epidemic Awareness Week. My understanding is that in Oregon, your rates of opioid overdose deaths are actually slightly higher than the nation's. About 3 Oregonians die every week from opioid prescription drugs. The graph there, the higher line is the opioid prescription drugs. Heroin overdose deaths is the lower line. There's also this clear link between the prescription drug abuse and the heroin use. I've been working with Snohomish Health District, and in their survey of heroin users, they found that over half were also abusing prescription drugs, amphetamines, opioids, OxyContin. Of those people already, you know, abusing both, 91% started with the prescription drugs first and then went to heroin. That's a very common trend. Many approaches are needed to address this complicated epidemic, from prevention to addiction treatment to increased recovery resources. On the prevention side, this slide outlines a comprehensive approach that's been in our national drug control policy for many years, educating providers and the public, expanding prescription monitoring programs, providing safe drug disposal, safe medicine return programs, focusing on enforcement, pill mills and doctor shopping. I believe Oregon, like Washington, has taken action on 3 of these, but the secure medicine return programs have largely been left to the local level, and then we're lagging behind on those in many communities. So one of the past barriers to medicine take-back programs was that the Controlled Substances Act at the federal level, just unintended consequence, prevented anyone except law enforcement from taking back controlled medicines like OxyContin and the stimulants. There was work done to pass a law to change that, and in October of 2014, the DEA issued their rule on how residential medicine take-back programs can take back controlled drugs along with all other medicines. They can all go in the same bin, prescription, over-the-counter, controlled or not. It authorizes 3 collection methods, secure collection receptacles at that list of all those DEA-licensed entities. These are places that already securely manage controlled substances. And really importantly, pharmacies and hospitals are on that list. Far more convenient locations than having a drop box at a police station, which is currently what we've been relying on. Also, take-back events can still be run by law enforcement, and other groups can collaborate with them on those. And then mail-back programs can also be offered. So this change in federal regulations is a great opportunity to expand the type of collection sites. The rule also makes it easier for the transport and disposal companies that, you know, that provide services to hospitals and such. They can now service these drop-off programs too. So that makes the whole chain of custody all the way to safe disposal by high temperature incineration much easier to accomplish. Unfortunately, as with many things, the federal rule didn't come with any funding, so it just removed that barrier. So current medicine take-back options, Oregon's kind of similar to Washington in this regard. There are some programs operating, but my take-home is going to be that we're only getting the tip of that iceberg in terms of what we're collecting. So there are take-back events. The DEA works with local law enforcement and coordinates twice-a-year events. I heard that at an event in 2015, one of those DEA events across your state brought in 4.5 tons of medicine. So that's 9,000 pounds of medicine. At a collection event in Lane County in 2015, it was about 425 pounds of medicines that came in. These are the kind of data we see all the time. There also are ongoing drop boxes at some police stations, not all, and at some pharmacies, certainly not all. Not a coordinated system either, really. Different programs operating separately, which is also why I can't tell you exactly how many drop-offs there are or exactly how much medicine is coming in. Law enforcement has been doing most of this collection. Some more pharmacies are starting up drop boxes. You may have heard of Walgreens has started a program, but they're not offering it all their pharmacies, just some. And then return mailers are available in some places. These are often provided for a fee, which is a disincentive to use them. And the amount of medicines you can fit in a mailer is fairly small. If you go to any of these collection events, you will see people coming in with shopping bags that they're bringing in. So in comparison to what we're seeing in other countries that have well-established pharmacy take-back programs, we know there's a lot more out there that could be collected per capita. So what's the challenge? Well, as with many things, it comes down to funding and resources. So the funding for these programs is piecemeal. Generally, it comes from police agencies, local health departments, solid waste agencies, perhaps from the pharmacies. The funding right now is really not sufficient to expand to the pharmacies and hospitals, the convenience sites. There really isn't much money for education, which is why you may even have a Dropbox in your community and haven't heard about it. And unless we promote these programs and make them available, they're not really serving their purpose. What we often see, too, is that programs find a bit of short-term support, maybe a grant or some fundraising to start up, but they can't maintain the costs of disposing of all those medicines, and they shut back down again. So ultimately, these programs, because the funding is unstable, they're not convenient enough for our residents. So that brings us to a policy approach called pharmaceutical stewardship. And this is an approach that provides dedicated financing and a coordinated system for secure medicine return. These stewardship policies are also called extended producer responsibility. The drug manufacturers finance and operate the system for take back as part of their doing business. So then the sustainable funding is tied to product sales. It's not a tax, and it's not a government-run program. The manufacturers, legislation typically is passed, and it defines the program standards and requires all manufacturers to participate fairly and pay their share. Then the manufacturers typically form a stewardship organization, and it manages the funds, coordinates the systems, forms contracts with service providers. Government's role is to oversee the program for safety and compliance. So these programs and laws are actually commonplace in other countries. I've listed these systems exist in Canada and Mexico. They're new to the U.S. However, there now are a number of counties that have passed these laws. Some states have considered these laws, and a couple of states have passed bills that get moved toward this, but comprehensive state-level legislation hasn't passed yet. But local ordinances have been enacted in King and Snohomish County in Washington State and in seven California counties. So Alameda and King County, this is a little timeline of when the law is passed, and I want to explain why there's been a little lag in that. The first two counties passed these laws requiring the drug manufacturers to run these programs, and the Pharmaceutical Association sued them in federal court, saying the laws violate the Dormant Commerce Clause. So that legal argument worked through the courts for the Alameda case, and the argument was rejected at every level of federal court. And the industry, in fact, appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court declined to review the case. So that legal argument has been resolved at this time. And then right about the time those court cases got resolved, the DEA rule got finalized, and we've now seen a flurry of activity from counties that need to solve this problem, and they're passing these laws. So implementation, a little bit wordy and hard to read there, but the manufacturers have created stewardship plans that have been accepted in Alameda, King, and San Francisco County. Other counties are reviewing those stewardship plans. I'll say a bit more about the program in King and Snohomish in a moment. So the industry, the manufacturers are now complying with these laws. 380 so manufacturers have formed a stewardship group called Med Project that is setting up these programs in the counties with laws. You will hear a variety of arguments from the pharmaceutical associations why medicine take-back isn't needed or won't work, or really they just don't want to be responsible for paying for it. And they have put out their own counterproposal of just throwing medicines in the trash, and you will see that messaging. And that messaging is concerning to local agencies working on this, because it really conflicts with the advice from federal agencies and local agencies to use a medicine take-back program whenever possible.
I think it's about time to wrap up, if you will.
So, and I appreciate it. This topic has its little complexities, and so I appreciate the chance to kind of walk through them. So the take home from this is that King County's law, we expect it to be fully operational in January. Already the manufacturers have formed contracts with 38 pharmacies, 22 hospitals, and 17 law enforcement agencies, and they'll be trying to get up to 90 sites to meet the requirements of the law. This is so many more collection sites than King County has ever had. Right now, prior to the start of this program, there are no drop boxes in Seattle or Bellevue, two largest cities in the counties. So there's going to be 90-some sites across the whole county. It's a good question and perhaps a good place to wrap up. How much is this going to cost the medicine producers to provide this service? So producers are responsible for the operational costs, including costs of education and promotion, and their costs will depend on the amount of medicines they get. But they themselves have estimated that the Alameda program will probably cost them about $1.2 million a year. A staff estimate from King County was in the same ballpark. When you compare this to medicine sales, which in King County are more like $1 billion per year, it works out to be a penny on every $10 of medicine sales, so or a few pennies per container of medicine. And so perhaps I'll leave you with paraphrasing an important public health saying, which is that a penny of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Mm-hmm. I did give you a handout that gives you some more information about the Snohomish County law, a little bit more detail. And again, I appreciate this opportunity to come and talk to you, and I hope that you will move forward this year on finding a way to create a comprehensive, convenient, and sustainably financed system for your communities.
Thank you very much. I think we will be moving forward in this. We had a couple of pretty comprehensive approaches back before that were killed by the DEA. So I hope now we can revitalize those thoughts, and I'm glad Representative Bueller is working on it with Senator Steiner Hayward, because we need to be forward.
Absolutely. So is this the new pill bill? Like the bottle pill?
Do you want a last comment?
Yeah, I think you did a nice job in outlining the need for this. I think the challenge is, of course, financing it and also finding the right level of take-back options. I don't think we need them in every pharmacy. In this state, we already have Walgreens stepping up and dealing with this problem, and actually a lot of the local hospitals are also developing these programs. So I think we have some options here for some creative solutions to a problem that needs a solution. So, and I like to have a more consensus. There's a lot of ownership in this problem. It's just not the manufacturers, but there's also the pharmacies, and also I think the CCOs have a role to play here. You know, if you just save one admission to a hospital for an overdose, you pay for lots of these places. Yeah. Right. So,
and the policy, as you look more at the details of it, it is really important to gauge your pharmacies, and these policies I've described, the ones in Washington State, do not mandate the pharmacy participation. There can be good reasons why, especially a smaller independent pharmacy, may not have room for that drop box or may not have staffing capacity. But one of the important things in the policies is it says that any pharmacy or hospital or police department that wants to volunteer to host a drop box would be included. Mm-hmm. And I think that will bring that convenience in.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is an item we put there because of some complications in implementing Senate Bill 469, I think, yeah, 469. And the Oregon Nurses Association and the Oregon Hospital and Health Systems Association of Hospitals and Health Systems were combined together in conflict with the Oregon Health Authority in terms of the rules implementing this program. As of last night, we heard that they have reached an agreement to move toward the solution to this problem that's satisfactory to all three, and they asked us to take it off the agenda while they work on it. The assumption is it's going to take some rule changes that we hope we'll be able to report back by December that has been achieved. It seemed to us any time that the nurses in the hospitals are on one side, we ought to be favoring that side. But I think we have it worked out now, and I'm very pleased.
That rare opportunity.
These guys are in the room.
Careful. Yeah, but I think they did not necessarily want to testify. Wait. Is that right?
Yeah. Oh. What? They would like to, the hospitals. Sorry. They would like to come.
You want to say something? Come on.
Good morning, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm the co-chair with my colleague Carol Bradley of the Nurse Staffing Advisory Board that was established under Senate Bill 469, which you passed, if you remember, in 2015. I very much appreciate Chair Greenlick's calling to your attention one of the unresolved and potentially resolving issues that emerged after the legislation passed and clearly not related to the intent of the legislation. And certainly will defer to my colleague to explain more. There are a couple of unresolved issues that we wanted to flag for you today. And in the interest of time, I won't say much more other than you should have either an executive summary or a full report of the Staffing Advisory Board either in front of you or access to. We have been meeting for a year. We functioned mostly from January through May as the Rule Advisory Board developing the administrative rules for the implementation of the Senate bill. And during that Rule Advisory, the two unresolved issues arose. We are very much looking forward to the work. Senate Bill 469, as Chair Greenlick said, was a good example of a strong collaboration between the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, the Oregon Nurses Association, and our individual member leaders. We're very proud of the work, and we look forward to providing another report to you in about a year about the impact that Senate Bill 469 is making on the quality of care provided in Oregon's hospitals. I'll turn it over to my colleague, Carol Bradley.
Great. Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. As Susan said, my name is Carol Bradley. I'm the Chief Nursing Officer at Legacy Health System in the Portland market, and I share the responsibility with Susan of co-chairing the Nurse Staffing Advisory Board. As has already been discussed, we've worked hard over the year to really resolve all of the issues between the Hospital Association and the Nurses Association, except for two issues at the end of this process, and I understand that we have motivated the OHA to help us resolve the overtime-related issue. The overtime issue, I just want to be clear, from our perspective, is critical to resolve, both so that we can provide emergency services and critical services in our hospitals, but also so that we can ensure for to nursing staff that we have an opportunity to ensure their work-life balance. Many of our clinical services have call programs. That means that nurses are on call to provide certain emergency services that may, in fact, be rarely called upon, but, in fact, we need those nurses available to provide those services. And in order for nurses to have a usable, a balance, if you will, between their personal life and work, they need to be able to superimpose their call schedules on their normal work schedules. And this has become an issue that I think I'm hoping we can resolve in terms of the way the rules are actually written. The second issue that surfaced toward the end of our rules writing process was an exemption that was made for the Oregon State Hospital. The Nurse Staffing Advisory Board did not have an opportunity to discuss that. We had concerns about the lack of transparency, that this really was kind of dropped into the rules at the last minute. Our principle that we would like applied in these rules is that, in fact, all hospitals are subject to the same evidence-based standards of what supports and provides safe patient care, and that no one hospital should have an exemption from the law, in as much as its underlying agenda is to ensure that we are providing safe patient care. So we are hoping to also resolve that in the coming weeks to ensure that all of our hospitals are really
following the same set of rules. I would just like to also conclude by saying that we really view these next few months as our opportunity to help educate the OHA about how hospitals operate, how we do nurse staffing, and we're looking forward to actually seeing the outcomes of the auditing process, which is also a significant part of this legislation. We think we'll learn from that process, as will the OHA, and with the process unfolding next year with audits, we really believe that we can ensure that we have a safe patient staffing environment for care.
You keep us informed as we go forward and see if those
Absolutely.
Problems can be resolved.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Thank you.
Thank you very much
Thank you.
For
Thanks.
Your work. All right. We move to our last item of the agenda. We've kept last because there are a lot of issues that we want to talk about. We have at least three issues to deal with the Oregon Health Authority. And who's going to start us off? Madam Administrator?
Director Lynn Saxon.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leslie Clement. I'm the Director of Health Policy and Analytics. And to my right is
Mark Fairbanks, Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Health Authority.
So this morning, I wanted to take an opportunity to introduce you to OHA's first quarterly report. It's not in presentation form. It's actually up on the screen, so we can go wherever you want to go with this. Before this report, legislators had received various reports, components of this report. So you've received a separate CCO metrics performance report and a separate finance report and a separate health disparities report. This is really the first time we bring all the reports in a summarized fashion, hopefully digestible, that will inform everyone, Oregonians, about how we're doing on access, how we're doing on quality, and how we're doing on cost. It is consistent with Oregon statute, which asked OHA to present this information, and it really is the status that is asking the question, how are we doing on our health system transformation vision? What did we expect, and are we getting that? So I'd welcome your questions throughout this discussion, and also would welcome any suggestions, given this is the first, to how to improve the subsequent reports. And the next one that is up is in January.
Will we be getting this on a quarterly basis?
Yeah, and I, you know, candidly, this first one, I think we had expected to have it all wrapped up a couple months earlier than we did, and just because this is new, the first quarter actually slipped. I mean, we had really would have liked to have this out in July. So we'll get in a quarterly structure starting in January. So you can that will be a predictable schedule for you. And this also goes to the Oregon Health Policy Board, and we did present this report to them as well. So one of the things that this report includes is a demographic section. So just so to get us to page 7. So we talked about this, or we heard you talk about this, with a contractor that was up here previously, in terms of the proportion of our OHP members who are in CCOs versus those that are in fee-for-service. And to your point, Representative Bueller, OHA is actively working to make sure that we move as many people as possible into the fee, you know, from fee-for-service into a CCO. That's the model that we envisioned for our OHP members, and we want as many of those members to experience that. And you'll see on this slide the bar charts that show you the number of members that are in fee-for-service and why. So the first bar chart is labeled third-party coverage. These are individuals that are OHP members but have another commercial carrier health plan that's primary to OHP. And when we first launched CCOs in discussions, we were a little reluctant. CCOs were reluctant to take this because they were secondary to a primary carrier who was making the first payments and making management decisions. We're actively having that discussion with CCOs right now, and I expect that will be a group that actually will move to CCOs next. The next bar chart is labeled Medicare. This refers to OHP members who have Medicaid and Medicare. They're often called duals. And in our waiver renewal package, we are asking for a policy change approval from the federal government that would take us from what is an opt-in program now to an opt-out. And what that means is today, a member would have to specifically request enrolling in a CCO, and what we'd like to do is flip it and make the reverse true, where they would automatically be enrolled in a CCO, but if for one reason or another they didn't want to be with that CCO, they could opt out. And that has to do with some restrictions on us related on the Medicare side. We have about 25,000 members who are in various forms of a fee-for-service. So, frankly, the top three bars on this chart, we're all looking to move to CCOs so that a bare minimum of OHP members would be in fee-for-service. And as you know, tribal members are exempt from enrolling in CCOs. They can choose to do if they want to, but what we're doing with the tribes is we're working with the tribes on better coordination with CCOs, trying to help improve access to specialty services instead. So I wanted to hit that. That's an important point, and I was glad to hear you raise that this morning. The map here, I think, is just to show you on a county basis what percentage of their total population is enrolled in Medicaid. And you can see that the percentage varies from a low in Benton County of just over 16% to a high in Josephine County of almost 39%. So there is variation. That's primarily driven by income eligibility.
Yeah.
I want to move to the next slide. This is just to make a brief comment. The racial and ethnic composition of the Oregon Health Plan members is different than that of Oregon. It is more diverse. But in terms of the impact after Medicaid expansion, it did not significantly change. That's what we're seeing right now. We're not seeing any significant trends that more diverse populations are enrolling in Medicaid. If you flip to the next page, I just want to make a comment here. There's some information. A lot of people often ask, well, how much money or income do you make in order to qualify for the Oregon Health Plan? I think that it's important here to say that the Medicaid expansion really produced a result that really allowed a lot of adults that weren't previously eligible for Medicaid to come on to the program. So we've seen an overall program composition that's really different. It used to be mostly kids in the Medicaid program, and that was by design at the federal level. And that now has shifted to more adults that are in the program. And that will change how we engage individuals in care management and coordination. It's still the case that for an adult, you qualify at a lower eligibility level than you do. Kids' eligibility goes up to 300% of poverty, and that just means that more kids can qualify under OHP or what's often known as the Children's Health Insurance Program than an adult would be able to access the program. I wanted to make a point here, too. Often people will say, well, our employment rates are pretty good, you know, why do we have so many OHP members still qualifying for Medicaid? And suggesting that they may be unemployed. And the fact of the matter is, as we see in this pie chart at the bottom of the page, is that most of the adults who are on the Oregon Health Plan are working full and part-time jobs. That seems to speak to the amount of wage they're making rather than whether or not they're working or not. So that was all I had with the demographics, and I don't want to go into great detail about reports and information you've already seen before. We have about 100-and-some-page report that goes over the CCO performance metrics. You have received those presentations before. What we know here is probably not a big surprise, but if you provide the right incentive, you'll provide the right focus. And so those 17 financially incentivized metrics have really got the attention of CCOs who have made significant progress in areas like reducing the emergency room use, the avoidable hospital room use, and or hospital admissions, as well as, I think really importantly, enrolling most of their members with a primary care provider. And that's a key foundation of our health system transformation, that somebody is there coordinating care for its members. So 70%, about 70% of OHP members in CCOs have a primary care provider to go to.
I'm going to put a marker just on for future discussion.
Sure.
In reading this and then focusing back to the outcome measures, while many if not most of the CCOs achieved their goal on a significant number of the 17 measures they're measured on, my impression was that the goals are very low in some of the measures. In some they're not, but in some, you know, you don't have to jump to get over them. You can stumble over them. we need to have a discussion somewhere along the line on how those goals are measured so that we know if they achieve the goals, they've actually done something.
Right. So I've captured that. Are they aspirational enough to make a difference?
For future discussion.
That's great. Going along those lines, there's room for improvement, right? So we can do a better job of oral health. Big issue. It's coming up all over. The Oregon Health Policy Board has gone out on a number of CCO listening tours, and they're hearing from members and providers. Oral health is an area that comes up frequently. The other area that comes up is the area of behavioral health, and we see that initiation of alcohol and drug treatment is not where we want it to be. If you go to page 12, I think this is the area where maybe peeling back some of the aggregated information gives you a picture of where we have an opportunity to improve. So with respect to our emergency room utilization, if you look at it in the aggregate, it looks like we're doing a really fantastic job. If you peel it back and you start looking, how are we doing for individuals who have a disability? How are we doing for individuals who have a mental health diagnosis? Specifically, how are we doing with those with the most serious mental health issues? And you can see that experience is really different in terms of performance. So this is an area that I think we have an opportunity to really press and focus on, because we're not getting the results I think that we should. Okay. I'm going to member satisfaction. I think just a couple things here. Every year we conduct a consumer assessment of healthcare providers and systems, CAP survey, it's called. Generally speaking, I think we see that most members overall are satisfied by the performance of their CCOs and their providers. That's also true with member satisfaction as you break it out by race and ethnicity. It tends to be truer for individuals satisfied with the services provided to their children rather than adults. areas that we have, we also on page 14, you'll see that we have a compliance responsibility in the Oregon Health Plan to track member complaints and grievances. In that area, we see a range of performance by CCOs. We also see that the two most common concerns are access, which is not surprising, how quickly they can get in to see a provider, and then also interaction with some of their service delivery providers. We do follow up, and our resolution rate for those complaints is really high. It's 97%. So it is just something that is an ongoing monitoring and management responsibility of ours. And as we see problems, we are starting to use both the carrot and the stick, quality assurance as a compliance or a heavy-handed approach. Our transformation center is the quality improvement side. So that's when we bring technical assistance out if we see patterns and say, you know, there seems to be a recurring problem here. How can we help you with some tools to address these issues?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. So I just want to be clear. So access just simply means they have an assigned physician?
No, access means that they get an appointment.
So I'm trying to separate the interaction with provider or the plan and that. So
yeah, the interaction with the provider could be even it could be of a personal communication. It could be that they were rude to me along oh, that okay. nature.
Thank you.
The health disparities on the next page shows these. All CCOs are required to have a transformation plan, and there are eight elements of the transformation plan, and they identify their own benchmarks of how they want to improve and how they're going to address certain areas. With regard to the health disparities, this table will show you how well they're performing on their own identified benchmarks. And you can see that some are doing better than others. This particular table has to do with literacy, improving the cultural competency of their workforce, of their staff, reflecting the racial and ethnic disparities so that they look more like the community they're serving. I think what we're finding here, frankly, is another opportunity that we can do a better job. Our CCOs can do a better job with member communications. And I think we're hearing that in those CCO listening sessions as well. Are they getting information in an understandable format? Do they understand their benefits? Do they understand how to use their providers? And now the next section is finance. So I'm going to turn this section over to Mark. And then if we have time, we can return to the report. I'll cover some other areas.
Well, you have three sets of topics to deal with today. So
right.
make sure you're monitoring your own time.
Right. So I think we probably will stop at the finance section. It's usually an area that people have lots of questions on. And then I would just invite you, if you have other suggestions, again, on how to improve the report, if you see something that's missing here that you want us to address in the future reports, please let me know. Okay. Thanks.
Chair Greenlick?
Can I just
yes.
follow up before? So you anticipate the lag to be about 6 months on future quarterly reports?
No, we will get onto a rhythm so that it will be January and April. And
a true quarterly.
True quarterly.
But, right. but the question is, what is it covering?
Right.
I mean, which is it covering a quarter or 6 months?
And we'll make sure that's clear in the report because that, obviously this really addressed the first quarter, the information and data here. So that next report will likely include some additional information. The other thing, just to you, so you know, yeah. there are some reports that are annual reports. So our CAHPS survey is an annual report. So that's not likely to change on a quarterly basis.
Yes.
Chair Greenlick, could I make a comment about that too?
Oh,
I
yes,
think that
ahead.
as we look forward to, from a financial perspective, in integrating with the delivery of care in all of the metrics around who and when and how and where. I think the nature of the quarterly reports will become much more, it's 3 months worth of activity. We do have, because this is our first, we're in a little bit of a catch-up mode. So I think the next report will be pulling us forward a little bit more with historical data. And then I think, I would imagine the quarterly reports will be pretty current. And they'll by their nature, they will be more focused on more topical, evolving activity.
Right. You have a data collection issue. I mean, if an issue report in January, it can't cover up to December, 2 weeks before.
That is correct.
So the question is, what's the time frame? Is it, will it be the second quarter of the year that you'll report on in the first quarter of the next year? I think that's a
point well taken, a point we'll make clear.
And just expectations of when they're going to come out, just so that we can be planned for.
Representative Geyer, did you have a comment?
No.
Okay. That's good. Mark, please.
So, Chair Greenlick, committee, once again, I'm Mark Fairbanks, Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Health Authority. It's good to see you again. I remember our last conversations were somewhat interesting and lively, so we'll see if we can have a little bit more comfortable conversation. So what I'd like to talk about today is as my colleague Leslie pointed out, is the finance section. And we have 3 years of information here, 13, 14, and 15, to walk through. And what I'm going to talk about is, first of all, I'd like to point out that certainly this information that we're going to go through reflects the current law and the current requirements of the contracts for CCOs in terms of financial reporting and performance. And the way I look at this is a great opportunity for us to almost take a pause, look at the program from a financial standpoint and some key dimensions, and then use this information on a go forward for where we may make improvements to the system. And I've heard rumor that there's some conversation in this committee about the next topic, which would be CCO profile, which is its structure and ownership. But I'll also talk about CCO margins a little bit. We'll talk about the medical service ratio and medical loss ratio, which are very closely related. Capitalization of the CCOs. I will touch on rate development, which, as you recall, was a lively topic back in August. And we'll talk a little bit about some risks and some pressures that we're seeing on the system, particularly as we're in the middle right now of our coming to a conclusion, actually, in our 2017 rate development process. So to go to page 16 of the report, we have summarized here the CCOs. All 16 CCOs are listed. You will note that in today's world, we have corporate models or business models that tend to gravitate to four main structures, which are identified in the top paragraph. So you've got 501c3s, 4s. Taxable private, LLCs, and one publicly traded CCO owned by a publicly traded entity. I think that I'd like to also point out to the committee that we're evaluating, now that we have the information we have, and we're into 3.5 years of this information, that we are diving into coincident with our budget activity overall and with the CCO rate development activity. We're diving into best practice. We're looking at the CCOs across the regions in terms of their structure, their local advocacy. It's real clear to me that this organization and this ownership structure reflects at least certainly an initial desire to create some diversity in the business models and to allow a community-specific structures and access to meet specific community needs. So I also believe that the intent was to generate as much of a development of best practice and innovation around transformation as possible. So with that said, we are working to, again, look at these structures, look at the individual regions, the individual communities, and work with those CCOs in talking about what have we learned? What are the attributes that we think we should carry forward? Where are the things we ought to be better? Do we see some evidence that, again, to share all of the best practices across the regions that we could improve? And then translate that to what that might imply to this kind of a structure. So I'm going to move over to margin. You have on page 17 and 18. On 17 are the dollar amounts of CCO operating and total margin. I think, again, as we talked about last we met, the event that is very notable in the first 3 years of this program is the advent of the ACA, or the expansion population, and its impact in terms of the volume of individuals who came into the system, and then growing body of knowledge around how they act and what are the characteristics and the acuity of that population. And so we can see that within our operating margin and total margins that 2014 is somewhat of an aberrant, not aberrant, but I would say it's an unusual year. It reflects activity that resulted from rates that were lacking historical data and trend information. So I think as we see across the nation, 2014 resulted in a variety of rates on capitated rates on the expansion population that were arguably high compared to the costs of that population and certainly to its risk. So in 2015, as you will recall, at the suggestion of CMS, but at the clear mandate from CCOs, we worked collaboratively with CMS to introduce a redeveloped rate process. We redeveloped our rates and how we attack or address the development of those rates based on population risk to the capitation rate itself. And so you'll see that all that activity is now embedded in 2015, but as we go forward, I think we'll see, short of a national change in the whole program or any other massive change in the population of the program, that I would suspect that or expect that with our rate development methodology consistently applied year over year, and the mechanisms I'll talk about in a minute in terms of the medical service ratio and medical loss ratio, that we'll see a narrowing of some of the variability.
Is it safe to assume, that the 2017 rates will be fully based on risk-adjusted models without other kinds of components, at least regionally based risk-adjusted models, or are we still looking at profitability and all sorts of other streams?
No. Chair Greenlick and the committee, yes, I think that your first part of your statement is true. The 2016 and 2017 rates were predicated upon a very discrete and separate analysis by actuaries to develop the rates to risk. The issue is, again, it's a persistent concern that there is some budget or margin influence on the development of rates, and that is not the case. Rates are not developed in that way, and our actuary cannot certify those rates to CMS in that kind of an environment.
Good. I just want to be sure that I think I maybe wouldn't mind a briefing on that, but I think it's very important that we get to the notion of actuarial competent rates from the whole population, not individually bottom-up.
Correct. So I draw your attention to page 18, which provides a somewhat colorful display of operating and total margins side by side for each CCO by year. And I just want to comment here that overall, operating and total margins, indicate financially appropriate, and sustainable model thus far. I want to point out a couple of situations where you will find total margins can exceed an operating margin, which from an accountant point of view, sometimes that causes you a little bit of heartburn or a little bit of concern. How can I have an operating margin?
Can you explain operating versus?
Yeah, operating margin is going to be your capitated revenue and all your direct medical costs, the cost of delivering the care. That's going to give you an operating margin. Below that are non-operating costs. So I'll talk about those for a minute. That non-operating costs can include any tax impacts. Some of our CCOs have, different types of tax structures, investment activity, and the gains and losses that one would have to accrue to generally accepted accounting principles.
Non-operating revenue as well as non-operating costs.
Yes, that's correct. Non-operating activity and revenue or costs. There can be grants that a CCO receives that are appropriately accounted for as non-operating income. And then, of course, there's a variety of other settlement activity that could be appropriately booked as non-operating. So that is why you'll find some fluctuation in those numbers as you peruse the list. So moving on to...
ask one question?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The one that jumps out, because we're trying to get to a place of equilibrium, is the Pacific Source Gorge in 20... whatever that last year was. Ends up having more variation than previously, whereas most mm-hmm. of the others seem to be trying to fall a little bit more in line. Can you say anything about that?
Are you speaking to 2015?
Yes.
Yes, and we see the operating margin at 18.8%. Representative Kenny Geyer, I would have to come back to you with that level of detail. I don't have that with me today. I would say that each CCO has, really to understand each individual CCO, we need to really dive into its what we call its Exhibit L, which has a lot of the needed detail on expenses and revenue.
Family camera's out of whack.
Thank you for the question. So moving on, we've got member services ratio and medical loss ratio.
Before we go, well, I think that, I'm not sure which page you're on. The number that jumped out on me was the $923 million in net worth in these 16 organizations. Is that, it's, you don't see that?
Yeah.
It's in these pages, right? I got it by reading the report.
It's there. I noticed that, too.
$923 million in net worth are reserves. I mean, it strikes me this money belongs to the communities that they're serving rather than to the individual organizations. And I'm getting very nervous about, for example, when Centene bailed out of Kentucky and Texas and took their profits with them, their reserves with them, the extent to which this money is vulnerable under our current model. I mean, can this $923 million that's been put together by government funds on behalf of individual communities disappear in the sale of a CCO to a Centene, say, or something else? Can it turn into cash for the owners of the LLCs? Where are we with that money that seems very much at risk after experiences we've had in the last year?
Chairman Greenlick, I think you're speaking to the overall issue of the reserves in the CCOs that have been accumulated since
right.
time, right. And at this time, we are concerned and we focus on each CCO's ability to meet or exceed its minimum net worth requirements. And we are not, at this point, do we have any rules or parameters around how much in a reserve that any particular CCO could accumulate. I think your point is well taken. I think it's something that we look forward to as I said at the beginning, after 3.5 years into this program, that we should take a hard look at.
Yeah, well, 4100 in the last session had something to say about it. I continue to worry about it, and I hope that the Oregon Health Policy Board that's working on the future of CCOs right now will take that up as a critical issue.
Thank you. Any other questions at this point? It's funny how this part of the whole presentation tends to be the most boring. And
not to me.
It's not boring.
It's not boring. You're riveting us.
Riveting. Yeah, absolutely riveting.
It's very interesting.
So, member...
Riveting.
Yeah. Member services ratio and MLR. We talked about this in August. I will, in the interest of time, just point out that the difference between the two is the medical loss ratio has a couple of other expenses that are required by CMS to be, or allowed by CMS to be included in the calculation. That's the distinction. And again, I think you'll see in the relative range of the medical service ratios for the last 3 years that 2014 played had a major impact to the fluctuation or to the variance that you see year over year. And again, I would expect that to narrow. The rules around MLR, the medical loss ratio from CMS, are now requiring an 85% MLR for 2018. We are stepping the CCOs with their collaboration and discussion and agreement, consensus, I should say, to maintain the 80% that we currently have, but on the whole population, because it was initially only on the expansion population. We'll do the same thing in 17. On 17, we'll move it forward, and then we'll matriculate to 85% for the total population to be in compliance, which is also consistent with the waiver, as I understand it. So on the next page, on 20, and then I'll move you to 21, which I think is a little bit better display of net assets to net worth, to your point, Chairman Greenlick. Also, we are expressing that by member so that it makes it a little bit more comparable, CCO to CCO, year to year, to track it. You'll notice on the right side of this particular page, you have little white markers in 2015 that shows you the where 5%, the 5% of the CCO's average annual defined revenue, which is the minimum requirement for net worth, is indicated. The only one that doesn't have a little white bar would, of course, be Trillium, because they are governed as a licensed insurer by DCBS and are subject to NAIC oversight requirements. So for this year, that wasn't a reported number to the Oregon Health Authority. However, they're well within it. And now, in 2016 and going forward, Trillium reports the same way that every other CCO does, as a separate reporting mechanism for our purposes. Then I'm rate development. I think we vetted that pretty well last time, Chairman Greenlick. And so I will not speak to it other than to say that we are right in the middle of it. We'll be getting down to the final rates with the CCOs here at end of month, and then we will have the 90-day CMS and the 60-day CCO review window underway. Risk and pressures, nothing new here. We're seeing in developing 17's rates and looking at discrete data, and I will again point out that rates are built on the discrete cost of delivering the care to the risk of the population. And we see pharmaceutical costs as almost legendary now, putting specialty drugs and breakthrough therapies, putting a lot of pressure on costs. There's a brief summary of this in terms of back pain, in terms of Hep C, and we continue to analyze it, work with the entire agency on different dimensions of how we can address these issues, talk to the CCOs about how we can confront and kind of overcome this so that we can overall stay within our 3.4% bogey. So that is my report. Are there any other questions at this time?
This might be a good time to ask Mr. Vandeweghe to join us and talk about where we're going. Well, you're here, Leslie, to talk about the waiver. He's hiding, so he thought he would get away with.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandeheghe, Governor's Health Policy Advisor. Thanks for let me come in for just a couple of minutes. I wanted to give, in the context of transformation, just give a quick update on where we are with CMS and the waiver. Before I say that, I don't know if this report's useful for you, but from where I sit within the governor's office, I love this report. I think it's super helpful to have all that information in one spot. And I don't use Twitter myself and can't imagine holding myself to 140 characters in any conversation, but Andy Slavitt, the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, does use Twitter, and actually was bragging about Oregon last week in reference to this report. So in addition to, I think, this being helpful for the governor and you all, CMS is looking at this too, and I think is also helpful in our conversations with our federal partners. Along those lines, as you know, we have a waiver with the federal government that allows us to operate the Medicaid program the way that we do. That waiver currently expires mid-2017, and we've been in conversations with CMS since March around that renewal process and what that will look like. The timing, is, as you know, we've talked about this in May, is a little awkward because we'll have a change of federal administration right in the middle of basically when we submit between the time of submitting the application and actually having the waiver renewed next year. And so we've been trying to work with them on what that renewal process will look like. They've, you know, initially they had a lot of stuff on their 2016 plate and really had us on a 2017 timeline. And we've had been having a number of conversations with them about how we could see about beginning the work as sooner rather than later. I shared with you a letter, it should be on OLIS, that we received actually on Tuesday that we're really excited about, that confirms CMS's commitment to our coordinated care model and just shares their excitement around the progress that the state has made to date and that they really still see us as a promising model nationally. We're also very excited, and you'll see in that letter that they've committed to begin working now on the renewal application. The application is in, and they are, have basically chunked out the work over the next year and are trying to get through as much of it as they can before the end of the year. At the very front end of that, one of the things we asked them to prioritize is the issue around flexible services. So those are the non-traditional medical services that improve health. Right now they're being counted in terms of how you build the global budget on the administrative side of the equation. We want to move that to the medical side of the equation so that CCOs are incented to be able to make those upstream investments that lower other health, lower costs in other places. And they, Lori Corner is out this week, but I do have to do a little bit of giving her some props. She's been working really hard with CMS over the summer and have made some great progress, and they've agreed to take that issue first, and they're actually really close to, I think, a final resolution on that, which is fantastic. But you'll see that they've sort of created a work plan to get through a lot of the work by the end of the year, which we're really excited about. The kind of bigger conversations around the proposal to build out coordinated health partnerships, which is really the idea of sort of taking CCOs one level out and focusing more on social determinants and transitions of care between the state hospital, jails, and the Medicaid system. We have some proposals in the waiver that really push CMS a little bit farther than they've gone with other states in terms of what they allow Medicaid services to be used for. We've gotten some good signals that they're excited to have that conversation with us. We'll be trailblazing nationally, but that will come, that along with the financial ask will come towards the tail end of the process, and that will likely be early next year. So I just wanted to share that with you. I know everybody's been anxious to hear where we're at. We're really pleased to see them affirm their commitment to the model in writing, and just wanted to pass that on to you all.
Jeremy, in the original waiver, we had a $1.9 billion at stake, and our promise at that point was to deliver the 3.4% maximum. We're asking for $1.25 million or something in this waiver. What are we promising as a result of that?
The state, so in the waiver application, the state proposed committing to continuing to hold that 3.4%. But, you know, this is really a negotiation in essence. We're early in that process of having that conversation with CMS, and so we know that will come sort of towards the end. But initially we did propose to continue to hold at 3.4%, and part of the argument around continuing to pull down some additional federal dollars is that the federal government is really the primary benefactor in the savings in the state reducing the cost curve.
Thank you. Are there other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question on timeline. So our old waiver runs out halfway through 2017, and the expectation is that this one would be approved by then and would take over?
That's the hope. I think having a work plan now in writing is really helpful for us. OHA will now begin kind of the next level down of conversations with CMS staff, and they'll begin to create work plans around each of those topic areas.
Great.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You go to the mental health piece next.
Yeah, Lynn Sachs and Dr. Miller and Bob Jim.
Yeah, that's the mental health piece.
Good morning, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Noss. I'm going to go quickly so that I can give a lot of time to my colleagues and our our partner in the collaborative. I just want to hit a few things.
You look familiar, but who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Lynn Saxon, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you, sir. Couple quick things. First, I want to be sure that you all have gotten your flu shot and that you are, you're working aggressively to do that. That's in my public health hat. It's going to be really critical this year to public health in our state for people to get their flu vaccinations. Second, I just want to say that we are working hard on a solution to the nurse staffing language question that was brought forward previously. I want to separate that out from the Oregon State Hospital exception discussion. That's a separate issue, which we will also take a look at. Third, we're very pleased today to bring to you information on the Behavioral Health Collaborative, which is the result of about 18 months of work by the Oregon Health Authority to internally sharply focus on behavioral health challenges in the state of Oregon. And those efforts, which have been on multiple fronts, have taken the following forms and have produced the following products. First, the behavioral health map, which we began work on 18 months ago and convened a statewide technical advisory committee to quality control and ensure good data is underway and has completed phase one. Secondly, we've been working intensely with our county partners, particularly six counties, on 370 referrals to the state hospital, which have reached kind of very high levels, unsustainable levels, and we have convened with those counties regularly. We've made some progress. We have much to make. That's a conversation with the district attorneys, with behavioral health workers, and with the counties, but we have made progress. Third,
that's the population of the state hospital that are there because of the patient's inability to aid and assist in their own defense.
Yes, correct. Thank you.
About a third of which are misdemeanor charges.
Yes.
About two-thirds felony.
Yes. Third, we are in the final stages of hiring a behavioral health director. Fourth, we have convened with our partners and colleagues at DHS and the Oregon Youth Authority, and we are jointly addressing the residential crisis for services for children in this state. You'll be hearing more about that, but we compiled and completed the first round of accurate data about that population over the last 5 years and what is needed to go forward to ensure that youth have positive solutions available to them. And then finally, Dr. Shahan and her team have been working on the operationalization of getting to behavioral health issues more quickly on the operating side and have made gains in that space as well. Those are minor wins, and that brings us to the Behavioral Health Collaborative, which convened this summer. In talking to my colleague, Dr. Robin Henderson, at then formerly in Central Oregon, now at Providence Systems, we did a nationwide look at who had experience in behavioral health that could help inform Oregon's practice and lead us to a better place. And we're very pleased today to have Dr. Ben Miller, and I'm appreciative of Dr. Henderson for pointing us in that direction. We've been having conversations with Dr. Miller for several months to drive a process to a better system of care for Oregonians that produces not just episodic outcomes, but long-term quality of life outcomes for the behavioral health population in Oregon. And so I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Miller in a minute, but I just want to say how pleased I am to have my colleague Bob Jundeff here today from Disability Rights Oregon. I've had the privilege of working with Bob for over a decade on identifying solutions, and I think sometimes we're just talking about problems over those years, but we're now focused on solutions, so we're very excited to have him here today. One last point, and I know you're all aware of this, we did complete negotiations with the U.S. Department of Justice, and we now have an Oregon performance plan for the SPMI population in Oregon. That is 30,000 Oregonians who really rely on us to bring 21st century solutions to their needs on an ongoing basis, and we will be doing that work collaboratively.
Those initials are persistent and severe
and persistent mental illness, yes. And we'll be doing that work in collaboration with the state hospital, which last week we learned is apparently the leading model for much of the country in how to operate a system of care for people that is focused on their needs. And we will be having multiple state visits in the next 60 days as other states visit Oregon to see how to develop their state hospital model. So I'm very, and the credit for that, of course, goes to Superintendent Roberts, so I just want to give him a little shout-out today. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Ben Miller, who's going to tell you about the collaborative and our challenges there. I will tell you, we've had a little discourse and intensification of emotions in that meeting, which tells me that we're bringing tough issues to the table and having frank conversations. So I'm optimistic that by December we will bring to you recommendations that are of how we go forward with Oregon's behavioral health system, and I think the collaborative is willing to really roll up their sleeves and have those tough conversations, which I applaud them for. Dr. Miller.
Thanks, Director Saxon and Chair Greenlick and committee. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce myself and talk a little bit about this process that I think is actually becoming very exciting, as Director Saxon just alluded to. So my name is Ben Miller. I'm the director of the Eugene S. Farley Jr. Health Policy Center at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. I'm an associate professor of family medicine and a clinical psychologist by training. I am actually not new to your state. We've had the pleasure of working in your state for the last 4 years with several of your communities, including Bend, Columbia Gorge, Hood River area, around CCO and behavioral health. I have to admit, I was a proud papa sitting in the front row just a few minutes ago when a couple of the testimonies referenced work that we've been working on for the last several years. Specifically, I've been the principal investigator on the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality's work around behavioral health. Additionally, I've been faculty for CMS for the CPC initiative, the first round, and hope to do so for the CPC Plus. That's me in a nutshell. The collaborative is really a great example of what happens when you take local innovation, leadership, and try and do something that's actually difficult. Transformation is not easy, or else we would have done it a long time ago. And many states, including your own, are struggling with the need to better address mental health, substance use issues. Behavioral health is on everyone's top list of things that they have got to figure out. And so this collaborative is a wonderful example of trying to figure it out. As Lynn alluded to, we've had some norming and storming. We've had some initial discussions where we started with what's the problem we're trying to solve. And so we created a problem statement that we're happy to share with you that really describes the need to address fragmentation at all levels, clinical, payment, delivery, et cetera. We then grounded that problem statement in what we think of as a conceptual model, a framework, so that people just didn't say, well, I want to do a new program or I want to throw money at this. I want to be able to look at this as a systems approach and systematically address some of the issues that are fundamental to achieving true population health for behavioral health. We've had 4 meetings. The last meeting, we put forward a straw proposal model that was, I think, quite progressive. And we essentially tried to establish this notion of what happens when you create in your system no wrong door for behavioral health, where wherever people present in the system, they can get access or interventions, appropriate interventions for behavioral health services. That is a daunting task. It's daunting conceptually, and it's even more daunting when you think about implementing. But it is the charge of this collaborative to come up with recommendations to do that. Moving forward, we have 6 more meetings to get to December, and we've begun to create this process of work groups. And I'll tell you briefly, the work groups are around data, workforce, payment reform and finance, waste, outcomes, and scope of responsibility. Each one of those is going to have a charge. And within that charge, we're creating what we think of as non-negotiables, things that they have to talk about, ways that we can connect programs to programs in the state of Oregon, ways that we can build off of innovations that are already happening, like found through CCOs. We know that there are local innovations in communities that need to be connected to broader reform efforts, and that's really going to be the charge of the groups. For the next 2 meetings, beginning next week, we will have 2 sessions specific to this, and we will be hopefully getting some more actionable items that come from that. In closing, this is as quickly as I can talk. In closing, I think that you all...
Don't speed up.
Well, you wouldn't know I'm actually from Tennessee, and we do speak slower now. The further away I get, the faster I speak. We do have a heavy lift ahead of us, and I would be remiss not to at least mention this to the committee, that we're talking about changing culture. We're talking about fundamentally rewriting history and doing things that I think are quite different than the way that we've always done them. That's the right place to be. If fragmentation is the enemy, integration is the answer. And behavioral health for too long has been an afterthought, and now it's come to the forefront of, I think, our discussions in health policy. So I want to thank you for the time. Thank you for the opportunity to work with you all, and I'll turn it over to Bob.
Bob?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Nose, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and I was very pleased to be invited.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did want to comment following your comment, having been involved in health policy for dating back to the 80s. We've talked for a long time about mental health parity. Mm-hmm. We've had a long journey. I just thought today is a remarkable accomplishment, and it needed to be brought out. We're getting there, and we realize that if treatment's going to be effective, it needs to be holistic.
Yeah.
It's not a simple matter, and if people are really going to live happy and effective lives, they've got to be treated as a full person. And it's a very special moment, and I'm sorry, but I just thought we needed to acknowledge this because in my 30 years of being here, I've been here 20, but 30 years of involvement in this topic, this is a marker day.
Bob, you've been at it for a while, too.
Yeah. I was going to say that Representative Kenemer just gave my testimony.
Sorry to have interfered.
Do I need to introduce myself again, or am I on the record?
You're on the record.
Okay. I was very pleased to be invited to be on the collaborative, and I just want to explain why that is. Now, Disability Rights Oregon has been advocating for people with mental illness for about 30 years now, and we receive complaints of people who are experiencing difficulties in the system. We don't receive funding through Medicaid, so we don't really have a financial stake in this process and in the services, but we work with the people who are directly affected by them. Why is this an enormously opportune moment to have this planning process come together? Well, as you know, when we embarked upon health care reform, we talked about integrating mental health and physical health services and chemical dependency services because we recognize that human beings have all these problems, and addressing them affects their entire health and the public health. And we embarked upon this process of trying to bring integration into the CCO model. What we have seen is that in some places, some very good things have happened as a result of that. And in some places, we really haven't made much progress. So there's things to be learned and there's knowledge to be spread, but we need to recognize what that knowledge is, those practices are, and move them out across the state so that we can have some level of uniformity. Another important piece of this is the work that you've done in improving the state hospital. We now do have a state hospital that has done culture change, has moved new values into our mental health system, and that, frankly, needs to be spread. And it is a good point at which to spread that new knowledge and understanding. The last thing is the work with the Department of Justice. The U.S. Department of Justice came to Oregon over 10 years ago because of conditions in the state hospital. We made great improvements there, and as we moved into the community, we recognized that we didn't have a community crisis system that was structured in a way to keep people out of the state hospital, to keep people out of jails, and to keep people out of having to live on the street. There are lessons that we've learned that now we can implement with the proper planning and financial support to get that work done. Let me just add that even we advocates recognize that there's a finite amount of resources, and in order to address the needs of our population, we need to make better use of that money. So all those opportunities have come together right now. While that's happening, we continue to see individuals who are sitting in jail beds who don't belong there, who are sitting in the state hospital, in ERs, who are just stuck. We see families who have a child who is exhibiting suicidal behaviors, who can't get help. I could go on and on. We still have those problems, but this is an incredible opportunity for us to move forward to try to address them effectively. So I'm very happy to tell you that this is a good process. It's a difficult process. The one thing I would add, and Representative Greenlick, you know, is that the state mental health authority doesn't tell everybody exactly what to do. It is a process that encourages, that supports, that contracts for services, and tries to incentivize a new direction. In order for that to work, it takes culture change. It takes a high degree of understanding what we're trying to accomplish and coordination. And getting 50 people in the room talking about it is the way to go.
We need to move on because I want a little bit on the dental task force. This has been a really important reform. Let me ask you a question on the way. The dental folks will join us while I'm asking. An unrelated question. We're going to be spending a lot of time in the next session working on getting all kids covered. Is there something that you folks are up to get ready for that, to help that process?
Yes, I think our team has compiled the information, the scope of the need, the cost of responding to that need, and it is in our budget proposal to the state.
Oh, that's great.
To DAS.
We'll see if it comes out.
Okay.
I think it's going to be very much on our mind.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Miller, for joining us. We have a few minutes left, if I can have the dental task force group. Go for it.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is David Simnett, Health Policy Director at the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to speak to you about the work that we have going on regarding oral health access for members on the Oregon Health Plan. I'm also joined by Matt Sinnott with Willamette Dental Group, who co-chairs the work group that's discussing oral health issues. So I'm going to provide some background information about establishing the work group and the task, and then Matt's going to share some of the discussions that have occurred within the work group and draft recommendations that they're working on to finalize. So as you may know, as part of having a Medicaid program, federal regulations require that each state establish and maintain a Medicaid advisory committee. In Oregon, members are appointed by the governor and represent a broad cross-section of stakeholders across the Oregon health plan. So this includes providers, advocates, CCOs, and OHP members. And the MAC is an active group and regularly makes recommendations to the Oregon Health Authority on opportunities that they see to improve our Medicaid program. Earlier this year, staff at OHA and the MAC began talking about significant changes that have occurred within the Oregon Health Plan in the past few years that impact oral health specifically. So just a couple of examples. So more than, as you're aware, of course, but more than 400,000 Oregonians were newly enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan as a result of Medicaid expansion. We integrated oral health benefits into the coordinated care model and put those under CCOs, and we restored dental benefits to adults on the Oregon Health Plan. Yeah. So we're also seeing indicators that the dental benefits, utilization of dental benefits, is lower with Oregon Health Plan members than it is for people who have private dental insurance. So on the Oregon Health Plan, on average in a given year, about a quarter of adults access some sort of dental benefit during that 12-month period. For kids, it's less than half, about 44%, within that same 12-month period. And then you compare that to Oregonians who have private dental insurance, and it's approximately two-thirds of adults and about two-thirds of kids with the private coverage had a dental service or visit within that period. So we know that utilization on the Oregon Health Plan is lower than it is for private benefit consumers, but we don't have a good understanding of why that might be. And so in talking to the MAC, they wanted to form a work group of experts across the dental community to be able to take a closer look at those and make recommendations to the Medicaid Advisory Committee on what Oregon might do to define what do we mean when we talk about oral health access, what are key indicators or data that should be used to monitor that access, and what barriers are we seeing to Oregon Health Plan members receiving oral health services. So the work group was formed earlier this year in the summer, made up of key oral health stakeholders from across the state, included CCO members, DCOs, providers, advocates, tribal representatives, and general community members. The group has met three times over the summer and is working to finalize their report and recommendations to the MAC, and the MAC meets next week. And the plan is that their recommendations will go to the Medicaid Advisory Committee next week. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Matt to share more details about the specific work of the group and some of the recommendations that they're looking at sharing with the MAC.
Thanks, David. First, it's odd that I'm sitting as Matt Sennett next to David Simnett. I don't know. If we were in the Senate health, I think we'd have a real dynamic. But that's neither here nor there. So I think, you know, David did a good job of sort of teeing up how we got to where we are. You know, when we started this work, it's inevitably a lofty task. I mean, this is not something that had been done before with the level of vigor that I think the expectation was put on this particular effort. So I think we've been supported greatly by OHA staff, really helping to facilitate the work that needs to occur between to stage how well we're going to be effective in meeting the charge of the MAC. And early in the meetings, we identified a framework. OHA staff brought it to the group, and it was really taking the Medicaid and CHIP Payment and Access Commission's framework for how they look at access to care. And it takes both sort of the personal environmental factors that individuals or families experience as it relates to their access to care, and then sort of takes them through a sort of a decision process of sorts, looking at the potential and realized variables around availability and utilization. And so we had structure to how we sort of went about this exercise. With the fact that we had a diverse group of stakeholders, I think we did really have a fairly representative voice. Early, when we were about at our midpoint, I reported back to the full MAC sort of where we were from a progress standpoint. And I think one of the areas of deficiency and an area that they wanted to see more activity related to really getting consumers and advocates a stronger voice in the work to make sure that we're not letting key pieces fall between the cracks. We'd tried to get those folks formally appointed onto the subgroup, but there wasn't a lot of community interest in doing it. So hearing the feedback from the MAC, OHA staff did get clever and looked to go to some FQHC meetings, some community advisory councils for the CCOs, so that even though there wasn't a formal voice sitting at the table, we were able to gather that feedback and make sure that it's informing the work as sort of a checks and balance to say, is what we have sufficient given the feedback we're getting? We met earlier this week on Tuesday, and at this point we have agreed to a definition of what access to oral health care is. We've also set the framework, and that framework is built into the draft plan that we reviewed on Tuesday. The last piece that we were working on Tuesday was identifying measures that the OHA could use to monitor access to care. And a lot of that dialogue gets into sort of the stratification. You know, just having a measure, if everybody's in one pool, it's going to dilute what that access information really means in terms of pediatric versus adults, pregnant women, other ethnic or cultural considerations we'd want to make to sort of stratifying it to get more granular with the type of information we're learning about whether access to care is sufficient or not. At this point, we've got 3 days. The clock started today for the group to review a redraft that, based on the feedback and sort of the agreements made on Tuesday, OHA staff went back and literally in a 24-hour turnaround produced a updated version of it that the members of the work group have Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday to provide feedback on. At that point, feedback is in essence closed because we ultimately have to get this back to the MAC next week to present because it, in essence, we're doing this on behalf of them. So we'll find out next week if the work plan that was created and the framework drafted meets the charge that we were given at a subgroup level. And I think depending upon how that dialogue goes, ultimately the work product will go back to OHA. And we've provided some recommendations on what we think it should be used to inform and what different audiences we think would benefit from seeing this access framework and overall work product coming out of our effort.
Hayden, do you have any comment?
I'm encouraged that this process is happening, and I hope to see that move forward, particularly in the area of our pregnant women that we, you know, worked so hard to try and bring awareness to the fact that there's this population out there that is very difficult to find, very difficult to get into our dental offices, and then when you throw in the mix of it not being done through a CCO, makes it almost impossible.
Yeah.
And so it's a high hurdle. And I think we should take a multi-step approach of how to do that, including some of them in the CCOs if we can, getting a network that the state itself goes out and tries to recruit rather than kind of a buyer beware, go find your own dentist attitude or approach. And so I'm encouraged. Kenny Geyer has fought very hard for this, very supportive of her efforts. So I hope that we come with a resolution that actually, you know, my hope is that we end up with the patient in the chair getting the service.
Yeah.
Dr. Turner, how confident are you that we're going to really make a big improvement by where this is going?
I'm optimistic. I would say I wish I was more confident, but we don't know what we don't know right now, and we're sort of entering into a space that we've never really tested how effective we can be in monitoring this. I think the need is there, Chair Greenlick. I think we need the oversight, and it's got to be an area that's understood, not anecdotally interpreted. And we know there's gaps, and pregnant women is one, and as dental becomes a more meaningful part of the coordinated care model, there's going to be more. Our ability to know where the members are at a disease level of detail or cohort status will be important. I mean, if we don't know how to access the members to get them in, it's going to be hard to measure it. And we know that if you look at information coming through complaints and other sources, access to care is probably not adequately understood, and that probably means it's not adequately being delivered in a manner that's considerate of the current size of our caseload population and the different cultural, ethnic, and even economic indicators that seem to impact whether access to care is sufficient for the totality of our OHP membership.
One thing I want to continue to stress is the network. The network. All of our CCOs are required to have a network. I'm not seeing that level of commitment yet. With this population, with the open card population, for the state, if they're going to keep them in that realm of how their services is accessed, we've got to add a network. We've got to get out there and have the same type of requirements so you have an adequate network to do that. And I'm not seeing enough work there, I don't think, yet.
Yeah, and I'd say our work is also focused on the CCO model, too.
Sure.
So, I mean,
sure.
I think we weren't there. I think there's a separate body of work that OHA was working on more specific to the open card population. But your point's well taken. I think we're sort of focusing on both scenarios, knowing that the end goal is the CCO model. And, you know, if it's not sufficient in one particular program, we can't say with confidence it's sufficient in the other either. So I think it's sort of a top-down approach that we've been looking at it. But absolutely, we got to be mindful to both sides of the equation and how those transitions occur or don't occur.
Representative Nose?
I'm just wondering, is part of the problem we don't reimburse dentists, you know, good enough to basically, it can only take so many people before it impacts their ability to run their business.
If the reimbursements and the ability to file the claim and receive a timely reimbursement for that claim, so it's not just cost, but it's the amount of staff to be, how long it takes, how difficult it is to keep up your ability to build that process. So there's multiple administrative steps that have to take place that are large barriers, and when you're receiving less than the cost of just providing the service, how do you get that network?
Yeah.
So the answer is just not go out and sign up more dentists. The answer is that you have to look at that process and evaluate, can we make this work?
Yeah. And just back to Vice Chair Nose and Rep. Hayden, I think we have – one thing we did with this MACPAC framework was we took some creative freedom to enhance it in a way that we thought was more suitable in Oregon. So we added a category that's really looking at structural elements and systems of care pieces and things like the financing and the administrative systems or even the rulemaking that could result in impediments. We did identify that in there as potential areas where there's some friction that can dissuade some of the progress that we'd hope to be making collectively. So we tried to take really a broad brushstroke approach while also focusing on some of those nuanced details that we know are critical pieces.
Representative Kenny Geyer, we're over our time limit, which we've never done before.
I appreciate you letting me extend that a little further. Thank you. I agree with Rep. Hayden, and I also want to say what a great honor it's been to work with him on the oral health issues and with very strong backing from our chair. And it's great to see this process go forward. I just want to just highlight a couple of things that I think the reimbursement rates for dentists and everyone along the chain, including community health care workers, hygienists, and ultimately therapists, dental therapists, is important to look at the whole thing. In addition to the reimbursement rate, how quickly that can go. And in addition to, you know, whether there are enough oral health providers out there, it's how do we get people into that? So whether it's, you know, the geographical diversity of where people are, it's also, are there language barriers? You've mentioned some of these things. Transportation, particularly for pregnant women who may have little children, you know, how do we actually get them to where the services are provided? The more that those services can be provided where other services are happening, healthcare or other kinds of things, even DHS offices. I hope that you're very creative about looking what the barriers are, what the solutions. I do know that the Oregon Oral Health Coalition has also very much prioritized reimbursement of oral health assessments, which I believe you do for children, but not adults. And that could capture, if you do more reimburse for oral health assessments for adults, the really important populations are pregnant women, and also the people with diabetes, because of the interplay between people with diabetes and periodontal disease. So those are really important factors. Also fluoride varnish, reimbursing healthcare providers at a whole variety of different levels, whomever you think are appropriate levels to be able to apply this very simple procedure. But there's, as of now, I believe not reimbursement for that. So I think there's a lot of directions we can go to expand access, and reimbursement is certainly a key, but there are other factors too.
Okay. So we appreciate it.
Representative Nose, you have a last word on that.
So I'm glad I'm on the Revenue Committee, because we're going to have to figure out how to get more resources for this.
All right. Thank you all your presenters today. Thank you, committee. We are adjourned, for the record.
No.
8 minutes late.